Chicago theater director Bill Brown, and The Worst with Kristen Toomey and Adam Burke. And now here's your host, a man who spent 20 minutes trying to find a pair of socks, Justin Kaufman.
That matched. A pair of socks that matched. I don't want to give away a method to my madness, but I don't put them together. I don't know about you, but find myself, I don't know if what it is, but I feel like I want my socks to be free range. And so I don't put them together when I put them back in the dresser. And so then I do spend like 10, 15 minutes trying to find another pair. Am I alone in that, Pete? That's probably not alone. That's something that guys do, right?
No, I'm a folder.
You
keep
fold
them together. Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yep.
It surprises me.
And does it?
Well, I mean, you're the guy who's like, you know, I wear the same jeans. It's, you know, four shirts in rotation. Then you fold your socks.
Yeah, fold them. Got to keep them at the ready. And I get really irritated if I lose one, if I can't find the match.
I honestly buy a pair of socks. Like I get a three pair, you know, the Dockers. I bring them home. And it takes probably about 8 minutes for me to lose one sock. Like, I'm just like, I don't know where it went. They're probably all somewhere stuck in my washer. That's what causes all the problems with my washing machine.
Yeah. What's going on with that?
Dude, all right. Terrible, terrible start to the show. You want to bring me down?
Oh, sorry.
To start a beautiful show with a lot of great, great
stuff. We can talk about it later.
It's a bad news story. I had a washer-dryer problem. I'll tell it real quick. Washer-dryer problem. I've complained about it on this show. I complained about it that Sears was having a difficult time figuring out how to fix it. Sears is not, by the way, Sears is not Sears anymore. Sears sold itself. Sears Repair is a customer service unit offshore, and the repairs are a freelance unit that's not called Sears. They don't talk to each other. They rarely show up when they're supposed to. They can't fix anything because I don't think they know how. Ended up buying a new one, which was tremendous. Went to Apt. Great guys at Apt. Bought a new washer-dryer. It's coming this week.
Great.
When I went to my wife went to get some measurements, she pulled out the washer a little bit. The back hose, we have a stackable because we live like in a condo.
Yeah.
The back hose came undone, and the water started gushing everywhere. Everywhere. This was Saturday night. Everywhere. I couldn't stop it. Like, I put a towel on it, and I couldn't reach the water shut off because it was behind this stackable unit in this real tight closet. That's one of the problems with, you know, where I live. It's just customized. The closet is customized. So, you know, I finally got a yardstick from the garage, and I, like, slammed the – I finally was able to get the water shut, and then the water dripped down and ruined the ceiling below. So my – because I have a duplex kind of thing – so the water rolled down and leaked through, so now I have to get a whole new ceiling.
Oh, yeah. Nuts.
It's terrible. It all happened like it was like my prelude to my birthday.
Right.
It was a terrible situation. And so contractors are going to be out. We're going to tear up the ceiling, all that kind of stuff. So nice little expense to fix the ceiling.
We live in a condo as well, and just, you know, one floor, but we have had the neighbor above us fairly irresponsible and has flooded twice.
Yeah.
And not a shower, a toilet.
So the toilet just goes crazy?
So we came home one night.
Oh, no.
And their bathroom is above our bathroom. It's, you know, the same design or same layout.
Right.
So we go into the bathroom, and there is
cloudy water.
Yeah, like all over our bathroom,
man.
Towels, toothbrush. You had to take off everything, and then our ceiling was destroyed. So we had to have them come out and fix it, and then it happened again.
See, that's, I mean, you know, the one comforting thing about having a problem like that, a water problem like that, is you have so many stories of people you know is like, that happened to me. I have so many different people from my relatives to others like, yeah, I had water damage from this or that or whatever.
Something that you deal
with.
It's
just something you deal with. It's just a bummer it happened. And it all stems back to not being able to fix the washing machine in the first place. And it was such a just a horrendous customer service experience. Like, I mean, I honestly can count. I think it was six or seven appointments. Four times of those six or seven, they didn't show. Yeah. And then the, you know, you've been with me where I'm like, I can't do this, I can't do that between certain hours.
Yeah.
And then on top of it, when they did show, they'd be like, you know, I got the wrong wrench. I'll be back tomorrow. Oh, you know what? You need to I need to order the parts when I'm in your house. So I went out to my van, so I have to come back the next day. That's just the way it works. I don't know. Talk to Central. Let me talk to Central. You know.
It's infuriating.
I just would say for anyone who's out there who has to work with appliance repairs, you would think that name Sears goes a long way. It really,
Not any longer.
I think they've just kind of carved it up, just sold it essentially to be like, well, it's, and they sold it, the fact that it had a good name. You know, and I'm like, oh, I guess fix a washing machine, so I'll do Sears.
Of course.
They just sold it. It's not even a company anymore. I mean, really what's happened is Apt has replaced Sears, ABT. And it's like that's a whole different experience. You go out there, you're like, oh, this is a company, these are people, they're gonna make it work. You know, we've already made contingency plans if the washer doesn't fit, you know. All the kind of things that these guys couldn't do. So I'm done with it.
Well, congratulations on the new
washer
and dryer.
Well, it'll get in once we fix the ceiling. So if any listeners out there have a washer and dryer I can use, I'm good till about, maybe good till about Friday. And then I got to start thinking about hitting the laundromat or one of my listeners' houses. So we could talk. I mean, it's a good 2 hours. I can interview you for free. That's my new deal, my new freelance project. I will interview you about your life if you let me use your washer and dryer to do some whites.
That's a great bit.
It's a great bit. We should videotape. We should go do that.
Yeah, that is a great bit.
All right, let's get on with the show. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is a Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We have a great show tonight. We'll tee it up in a minute. Stay with us. This is a Download, 720 WGN. I am Justin Kaufman. We got a great show tonight. Travis Knight from Leica Productions is here. And talk about the new movie Kubo and the Two Strings. Great director, stop motion stuff out of Portland. Some of the greatest kids' movies of our generation made by this man. So we'll talk with him at the big table. And coming up at 7:30, we're going to talk with the CEO of the Everglades Foundation about toxic algae blooms, something that's really affecting the Everglades, but also affecting Illinois. But they're making a move to fix it by tapping kind of an interesting source, Silicon Valley. So we'll talk with the CEO of the Everglades Foundation coming up at 7:30. But right now, it's time for the carryout. This, of course, our nightly segment where I read the news so you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. The news is out that former interim Chicago Police Superintendent John Escalante is taking a new job. Actually, his old job as the pitchman for Great America. No, he's moving to the private sector. This is right when a new IG report says that heads should roll for the alleged cover-up of information regarding the Laquan McDonald shooting. The Illinois Attorney General is now involved. Lisa Madigan saying that if any emails were sent about the McDonald case, they are public. Even if it's on your Earthlink, Mr. Mayor. Oh, yeah, what about Prodigy? Prodigy 2, Hotmail, all of it. Netscape, all of it. GeoCities? No, GeoCities is fine. Anyone who still uses GeoCities is irrelevant. Speaking of emails, the FBI fulfilled their promise to the people of the Republicans by releasing Hillary Clinton's private email documents. This is not the 33,000 missing emails. These are the findings from the investigation that cleared Clinton earlier this summer. So why release? Because there's a deadline for attack ads. Guarantee there are going to be some juicy bits for voiceover. She once emailed her friend to complain about her other friend. Trustworthy liar. Or maybe there are more nefarious emails about national security. One way or the other. It's been reported today that former Fox News chair Roger Ailes will consult on Donald Trump's campaign. So we should expect more scrolling at the bottom of the screen or more sexual harassment. One of the two. Again, just trying to be balanced here. New polls show Trump falling in Florida. He's down 9 points in Florida. That's where his golf course is. That's like his second home. And the guy who makes meth in his trailer who got busted for stealing Burger King garbage, he lives there. That's Trump's bread and butter. 9 points. Brush fires are causing evacuations in Southern California. In other words, it's summer. Seriously, it's like every summer. Ford says they're going to offer up a self-driving car by 2021. How will it differ from other brands? The Ford car? No steering wheel.
Yeah. Chevy was quick to jump in with, oh, yeah, well, our automated car won't have brakes. So one thing we know for certain, nobody's getting in an automated car without a steering wheel. This isn't Disneyland yet. So, but I mean, if you sold fast passes where our automated car could skip traffic and maybe also the Mickey Mouse ears, sold. I'm in. Give me two. A new study says that time of day factors into whether or not you'll pick up a virus. In fact, you're more susceptible to getting sick in the morning. So next time you're late for work, I was just trying to avoid viruses, sir, is a legitimate excuse. According to the census numbers, the New York borough in Brooklyn is now on track to surpass Chicago in population. It must be all that kale and vegan milkshakes they're consuming. Helps them multiply. When Reach for Comment, Logan Square hipsters were like, whatever, I don't care. This microphone out of my face. Wait, is this a podcast? I really want to be on your podcast. TV talk show host John McLaughlin from the McLaughlin Report died today at the age of 88. Wrong! 89! Next! That's my homage. Rest in peace, John. In weather, did it stop raining? Good. The rain's gone, but the heat is back. It's a trade-off. I'll take it. In sports, the Cubs took game one against the Brewers. Can I be honest for a second? Who's on the Brewers these days? Matt Garza? Okay. Ryan Braun? Name a third. I dare you. I'll let you look it up. Ricky Weeks? Nope. Lou Croy? Nope. Aramis Ramirez? Nope. Robin Yount? Ted Simmons? Raleigh Fingers? Pete Vukovic? Bring back the real Brew Crew. Come on. It's ridiculous. They're underway with game two. Jason Hamill's pitching. The Southsiders go to Cleveland, and the rally to get back in it starts now. Yeah. The Bears are back at practice with the Patriots. Tight end Zach Miller was held out with concussion symptoms. Don't call it a setback. At least Coach Fox didn't, but sure looks like it. Olympic news, can't tell you, won't tell you. All I know is that Isles Bay, she's a awesome bay. Okay? Okay. And that beach volleyball team is in the semis. I believe the diving pool is still green, and that Ryan Lochte was still mugged. That's pretty much the Olympic update. Track and field tonight. And finally, Britney Spears is back. She's going to perform at the VMAs for the first time in 10 years. Can't tell if that's a triumphant comeback or a desperate move to stay relevant. Either way, it's a desperate move to stay relevant. That's the carryout for August 16, 2016. Hey, who here is allergic to shellfish? We've got a special tonight on shrimpless scampi, so essentially plain spaghetti. Coming up, we're going to talk about algae blooms. This is a big deal. It's affecting the Everglades in Florida, but also here in Illinois. So what can be done to stop it? The Everglades Foundation has an idea. We'll talk with their CEO coming up here on The Download on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my man?
I'm doing well, my friend, and you. Happy belated birthday. I meant to say that to you yesterday.
You were a big part of my birthday yesterday.
Never got around to it, so happy
birthday
again.
You know what? I could feel it. I didn't need you to say anything. We're at a level now, man.
Sending that vibe.
We get that vibe. Today we're in a vibe. We both got pink shirts on. We'll see.
Looking good.
We're synced up.
I like it. I got the memo.
Good. Thank you, Rob Martier. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up at 8 o'clock, Travis Knight's going to join us from Leica Productions for his new movie, Kubo and the Two Strings, comes out this weekend. It's really amazing what they do with stop-motion animation. They build these sets in their Portland studios, just miles long, and essentially do old-school animation as opposed to, you know, what we see with the modern technology. And they've made a tremendous art out of it, whether it be the movie Paranorman, Coraline, great movie. The Box Trolls, they're all Academy Award nominees, and this year there's a lot of sort of optimism around Kubo and the Two Strings being Leica's Academy Award winning ticket. So we'll talk with Travis Knight about that film coming up at the Big Table at 8 o'clock. Well, right now my guest in studio is the CEO of the Everglades Foundation, a foundation whose mission is to protect the famed Florida National Park, Everglades National Park. It serves as a huge water source for Florida residents, not to mention its amazing ecosystem, which helps the environment and keeps everything in check.
Eric Eichenberg is here in Chicago this week to talk about a big threat to the Everglades that we share in this region, that everybody shares all around the world, and that's toxic algae blooms. The algae is clogging up waterways, sometimes even destroying the waterways for both recreation and drinking, and can even be harmful to humans who come in contact with it. But Eichenberg and other officials are attempting to fight this scourge with the tech sector. There's a new prize being floated to individuals, companies, and universities who can come up with the technology to rid our waterways of the algae. And it has some in Chicago paying close attention, as the Illinois Environmental Protection Agency and the State Department of Health have warned of this very problem this summer in the whole northern Illinois area. CEO Eric Eichenberg in studio with me. Good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Justin, good evening. Thank you for having me.
I'm a big fan of the Everglades, and this is something that I obviously, when I saw you were coming through town, I was like, this is something we have to deal with and we never talk about here in the state of Illinois. It's a big problem in the Everglades as well.
Well, it is, and we're in a state of emergency in Florida since June 29th when the governor declared that state of emergency due to toxic algae that has formed from Lake Okeechobee. The challenge we have in Florida, and listeners may not know the geographical boundaries of the Everglades, starting in Orlando, traveling south, Lake Okeechobee sitting right in the center of the state, right in the center of the peninsula. When that lake level rises, the only option right now is to open the gates on the east and west side, billions of gallons of polluted water being dumped. There's no treatment along the coast. So the algae forms, as you mentioned in the open, it's not only an environmental disaster, but it's also an economical one, and it's a threat to human health. So Everglades restoration is to cure that, but right now we're facing a water crisis.
And we'll talk about that. Let's talk about this algae, because it comes in a couple different forms, and it's something that is not specific to just the Everglades. We have the same issues in lakes and rivers here in Illinois and around the world. But right. What is it? I mean, what's causing this algae? Is it the changing climate of our planet, or is it something more nefarious, chemicals, waste, things like that coming off of industry?
Well, we just came off the two-year anniversary of Toledo, Ohio, shutting down its municipal water supply due to an algae outbreak in Lake Erie. Anytime you have large or small freshwater bodies near agriculture, near industry, the runoff from that sector does have an impact on the water quality issues. But farmers are not to blame. Farmers are trying their best to fix these issues. But we also realize the magnitude of algae in our freshwater bodies is so great. Government can't solve this particular crisis. And as you point out, it is a global issue. So this prize that we've announced on July 21st, a $10 million water prize, calling on all entrepreneurs, innovators, researchers to come together and let's find the technologies that are going to remove excess phosphorus from fresh water.
That's what it is.
And be able to do
excess
that.
Phosphorus.
It is.
You got to get rid of the phosphorus.
You have to. When we have too much phosphorus, that particular nutrient in fresh water, you see these blue-green algae outbreaks that we're seeing right now in Florida. And this is 2016. We can do better than what we're seeing both in Florida and the Great Lakes, certainly up in north in Canada for sure, as well as in China and places in South America.
Why not government? I mean, at a certain point, I mean, it's the government's job to protect the land and to give resources to states and state government be able to fix the problems that face the states that they're in. Why can't government be the ones that fix this algae problem?
Well, ideally, you would hope that would be the case, but you need political will many times to deal with these large issues. And we've seen again in Florida, Lake Okeechobee continues to fail. It continues to be a water body that is plagued by high levels of nutrients, phosphorus particularly, but also nitrogen and other runoff. So government in Florida is supposed to clean up. The state of Florida is responsible for water quality mm-hmm. in our state, as well as states across this nation.
Right.
And when government fails to ensure that we have a quality of life, we have 115 million tourists expected to come to Florida. They're not all going to Disney World. They're coming to fish, to go in our to boat in our waterways, to right. recreate. And if you have toxic algae in the waterway, it's an impact on the economy.
And so where did the idea come from? I mean, I'm just fascinated, and you're kind of on a nationwide tour to sort of talk about this prize, but where did the idea come from to go past the government, to go straight to the entrepreneurs, to try and find someone to come up to build a technology to fix this?
It was in a boardroom in Palm Beach as the Everglades Foundation Board of Directors sat around about 5 years ago, We're pleased to have as our chairman Marshall Field V, hailing right here from Chicago. Marshall and his colleagues sat around and said, knowing that government cannot solve this issue, let's put our money where our mouth is. We had a donor that stepped up and said, here's $10 million. Go out and seek new technology. Let's tap into that entrepreneurial spirit, and let's solve this once and for all.
Is there any – I mean, I'm fascinated by this because is there any – technology on the books that is used right now for algae blooms? Is there something that is the basis that companies can, or if I'm listening to this at home going, I'll build on that?
Well, we were privileged to be the only non-government participant in Mayor Emanuel's water summit 2 years ago right here in Chicago. And after we announced this prize, the idea of it, we had folks coming out of the woodwork. I remember a group came in from Dallas, Texas, with a type of brown soil that was somehow going to remove all the nutrients in the water. So you can imagine the amount of phone calls we're getting, which is a good thing.
Right.
When we announced this on July 21st with 350 people participating virtually in a press conference, we now have over 100 companies, individuals, universities that are in the queue, barleyprize.com. Phase one is underway, and within 4.5 years, we're hoping to change the world with this competition.
CEO Eric Eichenberger, the Everglade Foundation, is in studio with me now. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. I'm fascinated. I mean, algae blooms are something that, I mean, it's just affecting everybody. And it feels like this has been a cycle. You know, here in Chicago, we've had this where it's if it's not algae blooms, it's Asian carp. It's not Asian carp, it's another invasive species. If it's not something, I mean, it just feels like every other year there's some threat to our waterways. There has to be, and we think of all the problems in our society, there has to be some sort of wholesale or at least paradigm shift to take on these things. And that's sort of what we're talking about here on The Download tonight. We'll continue the conversation. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. In studio with me right now, the CEO of the Everglades Foundation, Eric Eichenberg. We're talking about the idea of finding corporations, people, individuals, companies, universities, and the private sector to deal with some of the toughest environmental issues. In this case, we're talking about algae blooms, toxic algae. They've set up a prize. It's a barley prize. And the idea is to award $10 million to someone to come up with the technology to solve this. I think this is fascinating because this could be the future of how we deal with some of the ills, whether it's environmental, whether it's societal, whether it's violence on the streets of Chicago, is tapping, essentially privatizing the response.
And prizes are not these competitions are not new. Charles Lindbergh won a prize, and now we have aviation. Canned soup was a result of a prize competition. So this is just something to realize. You have to tap into innovation. I will just say, walking around here on the banks of the Chicago River and seeing Lake Michigan, from what we're experiencing in Florida right now and what has municipalities around the Great Lakes have seen in years past, if you were to experience what's happening in Stuart, Florida, Jupiter, Florida, Fort Myers, Florida, the sheer smell of toxic algae,
yeah,
let alone
another
byproduct.
Right?
You would see tourism fade away off of Michigan Avenue right outside.
It's a major town. I mean, Fort Myers is a major tourist attraction.
It's the recreational fishing industry. We had 13,000 of that industry in Orlando last month. $9.3 billion impact on the Florida the economy as it relates to recreational fishing. You can't afford to lose that type of an effort in Florida. So whether it's real estate and home values that suffer, it's recreational fishing, the boating industry, all of these parts of our economy rely on clean, fresh water.
Yeah.
And Everglades restoration, specifically to our Everglades issues, keep more water on the peninsula, let's store it, clean it, send it south, ultimately into Everglades National Park, and we get to protect the water supply for nearly 8 million Floridians.
For the state of Florida, you know, and I'm just curious about this. I mean, is there a sense of civic pride around the Everglades that they want to step up and preserve this because it is not only a tremendous, just, you know, seventh wonder kind of thing, But it's also their livelihood. It's their lifeway. It's your water supply, all the things that you've been talking about.
No other place in the world like the Everglades. And in fact, 75% of Florida voters back in November of 14. 75%. The largest mandate of that election cycle came out to amend our state constitution to say, take one-third of all real estate taxes that are transacted in Florida, place it into a conservation trust fund, and use those dollars to restore the Everglades, our natural springs, all of the conservation issues that make Florida great. So we're seeing progress. What we desperately need in Tallahassee is political will to stand up to special interests and corporate welfare, and let's solve these
issues.
That's
something that we've seen government be handcuffed on, whether it be giving money for Zika virus out of Congress, or whether we see state governments trying to give. We had an issue here with the Asian carp coming up the Illinois River into Lake Michigan. That there was a lot of political hand-wringing about electric fences and how much money we're going to give. So there is something to be said about going to the private sector to fix some of these issues, because government just works too slow.
And I think the private sector is closest to the people at the moment. And that's where we see, we have a number of companies that are moving to Florida, high-wage jobs coming. Our state's open for business. But people are moving here, again, not just for a job and a way of life, but also a quality of life. Mm-hmm. And it's reliant on our water. And I'll just say, too, that the Everglades, 77 endangered or threatened species, call it home. We're in a crisis right now. And if government is not going to step up to do it, then from our perspective at the foundation, led by Marshall Field V, we've got to tap into the private sector. And let's solve it.
It's so interesting. And I could honestly talk 4 hours on Everglades. I'm so curious about it, because there's nothing like it anywhere else. The terrain, how it's set up. It's also gone through, I've had the good fortune of having a couple of tours at different times to go through there. But I mean, it's got its own problems, not unlike the area here, but it's got invasive species. It's got other environmental concerns. How do you at the foundation, how do you kind of, keep all those forces at bay?
Well, it's like that game Whack-A-Mole. You hit one, you get one in line, something else pops up. So we deal with 7 to 8 agencies, both federal and state, that all have a hand in this restoration effort, the largest restoration project in the history of the world. And it is challenged. Only half remains. And it's as Florida now grows, we're the third most populous state. It's a concern on the drain of the Everglades itself, no pun intended. So we have to ensure that water supply is protected, that we ensure that the species that call it home. But it is an economic engine for South Florida in particular.
What's the biggest threat? Is it the algae blooms?
Yes, the way we flow water today, the billions of gallons of water that we waste. And, states like California that are rationing water. Since January of this year, from Lake Okeechobee, the Army Corps of Engineers has dumped billions of gallons of fresh water that is needed for survival. Restoration of the Everglades takes that water. It stores it south of Okeechobee. It cleans the pollution through constructed wetlands that are south of the sugarcane fields. And once that water is cleaned, because you have two federal judges overseeing the cleanup of the Everglades, I mean, there's a massive amount of politics and legal issues. Once that water is cleansed, it flows south. We're bridging what's called Tamiami Trail, Tampa to Miami, Tamiami Trail. A strip of asphalt is being raised, 12-foot bridges, so that water can flow into Everglades National Park, and ultimately that water reaches the Florida Keys. So from Orlando to the Florida Keys, that geographical boundary is the heart of this issue, and we can't afford. I have 4 children, 10 years and younger. I don't want them to look at what the old man was doing back in 2016 and realize he was not part of the solution. We can't afford to lose this iconic Everglades. We can't afford to lose the Great Lakes.
I was going to say, this is, you could say that you can just pull out Everglades and put in Great Lakes. I mean, this is something that it seems like every region in this country and around the world, but specifically in this country, has some issue with water and restoration. I mean, that's just something that is obvious that's happening in this planet.
And I'll say too, Justin, we don't blink an eye when we want to expand O'Hare or Fort Lauderdale Airport, when we want to build a tunnel to the Port of Miami, $500 million project, or whatever the infrastructure project is. We don't bat an eye. But this is water infrastructure as it relates back to Florida. So this is a multi-billion-dollar effort. We're moving along. But that's water quantity. This issue goes back to water quality, where if the state of Florida is not going to clean up the water from algae that's polluting our canals and waterways, then again, we've got to incentivize people to step forward.
I think it's great. And I also think that, you know, obviously if a technology, somebody comes through, an entrepreneur, and makes a technology and the technology works, it's something that's going to be used around the world.
Yes.
Again, the website is the Bradley Prize.
It's the barleyprize.com. Barleyprize.com. And also EvergladesFoundation.org is another resource for folks, listeners. I know some listeners are in Florida during the winter. Mm-hmm. We look forward to seeing people back in the Sunshine State.
The Everglades Foundation CEO, Eric Eichenberg, thanks for joining me today, and good luck with the rest of the nationwide tour.
Thanks, Justin.
That was good. That was interesting, huh? I mean, I wouldn't even know where to start with a technology to clear algae blooms, but somebody does, right?
I don't know. Flamethrower?
I would love to be at your PowerPoint presentation for that $10 million prize. Ladies and gentlemen, a flamethrower.
He was very interesting.
I just think that there's something there about the idea of going to the private sector on some of these environmental disasters that are happening, because the government can't keep up. And then we ask them to do it, and then it's obvious they can't. And the way that it seems to be handled is to just sweep it under the rug or pretend nobody's looking. And when you have situations like what's happening there, it's no different than what's happening in Lake Michigan. Lake Michigan's got a ton of algae blooms. We just don't see it because it's such a big lake. But what happens when we get to a point where someone comes out and goes, you know, we haven't really been talking to you because we've been busy with other issues, you know, like the state budget. But 75% of the lake has been overrun. Like, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
So I think it's interesting. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the new movie Kubo and the Two Strings hits theaters this weekend, starring Charlize Theron and Matthew McConaughey. The animated tale follows a young boy named Kubo who tells stories of quests and adventures until one day he's a part of one. It's a movie that takes on storytelling, community, loss, and the afterlife. It's directed by Travis Knight. Knight is the man behind the production company Laika. They brought us the great animated films Coraline, Paranorman, The Box Trolls. Laika has been nominated for several Academy Awards. Knight is not only known for his animation, but for pushing the boundaries of kids' films as we know them. And boy, do they need pushing. Travis Knight is my guest tonight at the Big Table on Download. Thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Absolutely my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about Kubo. Great movie. I mean, it's really, really great. What attracted you? Because I read that this is a project that started way back in 2012.
Yeah, we've been working on this project for 5 years now. You know, the pace of an animated film is pretty glacial. These things take a long time to make. We take usually the first, you know, couple of years of these things, just developing the story, developing the characters, the world, you know, what the rules of the world are, what are the big ideas that the architecture, the structure of the story can support, and then you try to weave in aspects of your own life to give it meaning and resonance and hopefully universality. I think there's an odd thing where paradoxically, the more intimate, the more personal you make a story, the more universal it becomes.
Right.
And so that's what we try to do at the studio. But yeah, it's been a long time in the making, a long and winding road.
Well, you know, the movie is so – it's not only a great story and the animation is interesting, but it's also – I mean, and I think you've talked about this too, that you wanted to make it more of a beautiful film, to use animation the same way that film is, where there's these sweeping, grand shots and this animation that just is beyond what we usually see in kids' movies.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it is a big epic fantasy, and so if you're going to embrace something like that, you really have to go for it. I mean, at the beginning, we told our crew we wanted to make a stop-motion David Lean film, a big kind of monumental Kurosawan myth in miniature, which is kind of absurd on its face when you know how we make these things. I mean, essentially they're all made on tabletops, these gussied up tabletops in the middle of a crummy warehouse at our shop in Portland, Oregon, and it needed to look like it was lensed on an endless majestic vista. So it's kind of absurd to even take something like that on.
Right.
But that's what the story needed to be, and credit to the crew. They just did an extraordinary job. It looks like it looks like a stop-motion David Lean film.
Mission accomplished. The script, what attracted you to Kubo? Because it feels... You can feel the emotion that comes out of it.
Yeah, I think there were a couple things that attracted me to it. It was, I think both of them basically go back to my childhood, which is fitting since the movie is fundamentally about childhood and family and those connections that we have as children and as we become adults. You know, for me, I was an enormous obsessive fan of big epic fantasies when I was a kid, and that was a gift from my mother. In fact, when my mother was pregnant with me and when she was recovering in the hospital after I was born, the book that she was reading was Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. So that love of fantasy was something that was bestowed upon me at an early age. Incidentally, a big geeky love of Tolkien is not something that endears you to the ladies. Right. Something I was going to find out in high school. I found out that hard fact the hard way. But I've loved fantasy my whole life. And, you know, my dad, for his part, when I was around 8 years old, you know, he let me tag along on one of his business trips to Japan. And I grew up in Portland, Oregon. And from the moment I set foot in Japan, it really was like I'd been transported to another world. It was just so unlike anything I'd ever experienced before. It was just beautiful and breathtaking, almost otherworldly. And, you know, everything from the food and the, mm-hmm. and the style of dress to the music and the movies and the TV shows and the architecture. I mean, everything about it was a revelation. And it was the beginning of this lifelong love affair I've had with this great and beautiful culture.
I was going to ask, I mean, you know, to put together an epic adventure fantasy like this that takes place in Japan, how much do you have to do? How does your crew in Portland, Oregon have to know necessarily about the cultures, about the landscape, about the environment?
It's really important that you do your research, that you understand the world that you're stylizing, because even though it is a period fantasy, it's a fairy tale, but you want to make sure that your fairy tale has one foot in the real world, that you understand what you're stylizing. And so we do, for the first part of the process, those 2-3 years where we're developing the story and the script and the characters, we're also doing tons and tons of research and just making sure that we understand that era and that time. And so the film really is a loving homage to this incredible culture and artistry that comes from Japan.
You've had a great relationship with Focus to put these together. This you talked about this being an opportunity at this stage with Leica to attract big stars, to get people involved in your film. Is this the right project for that move for you, to have this sort of Matthew McConaughey star in the project?
Yeah, it clearly was. I mean, you know, we're nestled in the rain-drenched, patchouli-oiled armpit of the Pacific Northwest. And so anytime anybody wants to work with us, it's a bit of a shock to me. And so we aim high. I mean, we want to work with the best, finest talent in the world, some of the best actors on the planet. And so when we started approaching, 3 years ago, when we started approaching Charlize and Matthew about being involved in the movie, it was, on a prayer. You're crossing your fingers, hoping they'd be interested. And thankfully they were. And I think that really speaks to what is at the heart of the movie. It really is fundamentally a movie about family and about parents and their children. And, you know, for Charlize, she was a new mom at the time, and she wanted to do the kind of story that she could share with her child. And for Matthew, when we sent him the script, he actually read it in nighttime installments to his kid as a bedtime story. And so I think the thing that attracted our actors to the movie is the same thing that attracted me to make this movie, which is it's just a beautifully told, you know, rich tapestry that fundamentally is focusing on, you know, love and family.
Do you, as a filmmaker, as you see the evolution of the films that Leica has been involved in, do you look for a change in direction, or is it adding on what you've done before?
Yeah, well, I think that if you look at all of our films, you know, there is a continuum. I mean, there are strands of the same DNA that runs through all these things, because it comes from the same place, the same community, the same group of people. But we always want to tell new and different kinds of stories. We don't want to repeat ourselves. There's an inherent restlessness at Leica where we always want to challenge ourselves creatively to tell new and original stories, to tackle new worlds, to dive into new genres. That gets us excited. You know, we don't want to keep doing the same thing over and over again. And so I think if you look at all of our movies, they're all very different from each other, and we love that. We love creating new worlds.
Let's take a break. I want to come back and I want to talk about the emotion in the film, because that's the one thing that Leica has brought to animated features, is just this emotional response. You know, I remember having an emotional response myself to Coraline, and the same here, where you just, mm-hmm. there really is a lot going on for essentially for kids who are going to watch this mm-hmm. movie. Travis Knight, the CEO of Leica and also the director of Kubo and the Two Strings, in studio tonight. We'll take a quick break. We'll come right back. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio at the big table, Travis Knight. He's the director of Kubo and the Two Strings, which hits theaters this weekend. The movie, it's a great movie. I really enjoyed it. And, you know, my family's always been a fan of the work that you guys do because it's not, I guess it's complex.
Yeah.
It's emotionally complex.
Right. I think that, you know, we're not interested in making little pop culture confections. We're not interested in making, you know, candied coated things that go down easy. We want to tell stories that have resonance, that are thought provoking, that are thematically challenging, that are emotionally resonant, that actually mean something. You know, we pour so much of ourselves into these movies and we really want it to matter. We want to make movies that matter. And so with each film, I think one of the benefits of working in something like fantasy or with animation, it's a stylized view of the world. It has a nodding acquaintance to reality, but it's not reality. And I think when you abstract from reality, you can actually explore meaningful issues in a way that's stylized that kids can mm-hmm. get, they can appreciate, they can understand, and yet it kind of defangs it a bit because it's not the real world. What you're looking at is a stylized version of the real world.
I guess the similarities between characters like Kubo and the character in Paranorman or even Coraline, they're the heroes. They're in this moment. They have a lot of adversity to overcome, and they're almost doing it in a fantasy world, even inside the movie. Mm-hmm. But talk about, you know, setting a movie where the child is the hero and has to overcome adult kind of, you know, loss, emotion, things of that nature.
Yeah, I think the starting point is that, you know, we make films that are intended for families. And when we say that, we mean all members of the family. We don't mean that we're pandering to toddlers and the parents are going to turn off their brain exactly. and just hope they can endure this right. hour and a half. We want to engage all members of the family. And so that means, you know, we try to have stuff that are for the kids. You know, this is big action adventure element to this movie that's really fun. It's kind of like an Indiana Jones adventure that's fun to watch. But there's also an exploration of big ideas and deeper issues that hopefully appeal to an older audience. And so, yeah, I think that, you know, by putting a child protagonist, you know, sometimes the tendency is to try to water it down to make it palatable for a younger audience. But that is, I think that does our audience a disservice. I think kids are smart. They're sophisticated. And when I think about the kinds of stories and movies and books that I loved growing up, it was always those movies that treated the audience intelligently.
Are you a study of children's movies? Do you pay attention to the stuff that's come before you, the stuff that,
oh, yeah.
that's your contemporaries?
And, you know, certainly things that I loved growing up, and then I see the things that my own kids are exposed to. I have three kids myself, and in fact, one of the main reasons why I even started Laika 10 years ago was exactly that reason when I became a parent. And once I became a parent, as most of us do when we become fathers and mothers, our perspective changes. We start looking at the world in a different way through a different prism. And when I saw the kinds of things that my children were exposed to, when I saw, you know, the things that passed for family entertainment and how so much of it was vapid and it was just a sensory overload.
That, you definitely are a dad with kids, right? That's our life. No, but that's a life. I mean, if you watch anything from the stuff that's being presented on television. Yeah. I mean, there is sensory overload is a perfect way to put it.
Yeah, and I just didn't want to be a part of that. I wanted to make films that mattered. I wanted to make films that had resonance, that kind of stuck to your ribs. And you know, those are the kind of things I loved growing up. So that really was the impetus to start Laika to begin with 10 years ago, being a parent. And now, you know, making this film and making a movie that's fundamentally about family but has a child protagonist, we wanted to make sure that we treated him like a real kid and that we didn't pander, that we didn't speak down to our audience, that this is a kid. He's going through this issue in his life. He's crossing that Rubicon from being a child to becoming an adult. And, you know, there are beautiful things that we gain along the way, but there's also some things that we lose. And I think this is in a stylized way, we can talk about those things in a way that kids can understand.
And that's what I love about it in the movies that you've produced. The other thing, too, is have you ever been in a situation with Laika where there's some themes, some storylines, some things you want to produce that might just be too much for kids to handle?
Oh, yeah. I mean, undoubtedly. I mean, look, I know that I'm sure that we've soaked more than a few bunk bed mattresses in our day. That's never the intent. We're not trying to traumatize anybody. I mean, ultimately, what you're trying to do as filmmakers is you're trying to bring people together. I think that's what storytellers mm-hmm. long to do. They long to make those connections with people. They long to, you know, to kindle people's imaginations, to inspire them to dream. And, you know, that's what stories meant to me. And so that's what we try to do with our films. You know, sometimes as you're developing these stories, I think that, you know, we always try to find that artful balance of darkness and light, of intensity and warmth, of humor and heart. You know, we think that just makes for good, engaging, mm-hmm. enriching storytelling. And I personally believe that spending time in the shadows makes the light even brighter and more beautiful.
Well, that's interesting, because I would say that that's a big part of your work. I mean, a lot of the work is sort of in the shadows. There's an emphasis on the afterlife. There's an emphasis on the other side. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting for an adult to be and watching. You know, I bring my 7-year-old, 6-year-old to a, to see Paranorman, and I'm like, yes, I'm starting to learn something here. I'm not sure if I'm comfortable here, but there definitely does seem to be at least an interest or a specialty in playing in the shadows.
Yeah, and I think that it's just a matter of finding the balance. I mean, I think one of the things about this movie that I love is that even though we explore some important issues, there's a joy to it. It really is a joyous film. It's a beautiful film, and it's uplifting. And, you know, when I think of my favorite film-going experiences as a parent, as an adult, there are always those moments where I take my kids to go see a movie, and then on the ride back home, we're talking about it. We're talking about the issues that were raised. And, it's an opportunity for engagement. It's an opportunity to bring families together to talk about things that matter to them. And I love those kinds of experiences. And those are the kind of movies that we want to make. We want people to be engaged with it and then talking about it as a family. I think those are beautiful moments.
There's a lot that has to do with storytelling in Kubo. That's what I really like. There's even a line I paraphrase. It's sort of like stories live from one person to the next and the next. It's almost in a way that, you know, that our world is changing in so much technology. You really harken back to nuts and bolts of what it means to celebrate history. Mm-hmm. The idea of telling stories from generation to generation to generation. Your kids getting that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that is a fundamental part of who we are as people. I mean, it's kind of in the bones. It's in the DNA. My youngest son is 3 years old. And sometimes I'll just watch him from across the room when he's playing with his action figures, his little superhero dolls and all that kind of stuff. And he's creating these whole scenarios. He's doing the voices. They're going on these little adventures. And I'll just watch what he's doing. And what he's doing is he's storytelling. He's telling a story. Mm-hmm. And nobody taught him how to do that. That's just something that comes out of us naturally. And I think that is a fundamental part of what it means to be human. It's a beautiful thing. And I think it gets to what we try to do as storytellers, to kind of reach people, to create empathy. And I think that's what stories in their finest form do. Yeah, I think there is still a huge part, an important part that stories have to play in our lives. And it is a very fractured world that we live in, a very high-speed world. But I still think people long for those kinds of connections.
It's funny because, you wonder if there's a part of us that are longing for new stories, or at least to be around something that's unique and interesting and different. And I think that as we start to learn different cultures, and that's where Kubo and the Two Strings plays, this idea of almost learning the folklore of a different culture, of understanding where Kubo's from, his parents, the it's a different period, things of that nature. It's just, it intrigues us.
Well, I think that art is one of the few things that can cross barriers. It can break down barriers. Art can speak to us across time, across place, across culture. One of the key influences on this movie was Akira Kurosawa, the great master filmmaker. And interestingly enough, he was greatly influenced by William Shakespeare, who lived on the other side of the planet 400 years before Kurosawa was even born. And I think that speaks to what art can do. It can, across time and culture and generations, it can speak to us. It can reach a part of us that we don't even know exists. I think that's a beautiful thing that, that storytelling can do, that art can do. And, it's fundamentally what we try to do as filmmakers. And I think that, we live in an era of, regurgitated stuff, franchises and brands and reboots and remakes. I mean, it's constant. That's really all
we've
the only
told,
kinds of
stories. Yeah. There's only a certain amount of stories that work, and we're going to tell them so many times.
Right. And it's a shame because I some of my formative experiences as a kid, I would go into a darkened room, a cinema with a bunch of strangers, and I would see a new world on the screen. And that was always really exciting to me. And I think film still can be that, but we don't see that very often. And I think that with Kubo and the Two Strings, we are absolutely taking people to places that they haven't been before.
Travis Knight's the director of Kubo and the Two Strings, also his production company, CEO of Leica. Let's take a quick break for the news. We'll come back and we'll continue the conversation here. I want to find out more about your approach and philosophy to animation, because one of the things we haven't even mentioned is Kubo, Paranorman, Coraline, down the line, Box Trolls. It is unique in the way that you're moving animation forward and not just relying on what's out there. So we'll talk about that coming up after the news with Travis Knight. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio, Travis Knight. He's the director of Kubo and the Two Strings, which is out this weekend. Also the CEO of Leica, the production company that paired with Focus Features to put this out. The animation, it really is. You've pushed the boundary. We talked about the idea of trying to make it more filmmaking. Mm-hmm. These grand sweeping shots, these amazing. Some of the stuff that's done through the imagination is just great. Where does that come from on the animation side? There's a real different. This is 3D, by the way, but there's a real push to try and change the status quo.
Yeah, I mean, I think this film really does represent a seismic shift, certainly for us as a company. I mean, we've never taken on anything even remotely this ambitious before. You know, the way we make films is really unusual in this modern age. I mean, everything is digital these days, but we actually make these things by hand. The basic form of the way we make these movies is in stop-motion animation, which is a technique that goes back to the dawn of cinema, you know, 100 years ago, right, to when Georges Méliès was sending rockets to the moon. We use a lot of those same techniques, but at the same time, we also blend that with technology and with science and craft and art, and all these things are converging. It's a big roiling gumbo of all these different techniques, and I think visually, aesthetically, that gives audiences something that they've never seen before. It's honoring tradition and history while looking towards the future and doing disruptive innovation to make these things come to life.
What first got you into animation?
Oh, boy. I've loved animation since I was a kid. I don't think that makes me unusual. I mean, I think most kids do love animation, but I was a very special kind of child, and I absolutely adored it, and I wanted to learn how to do it. And so I tried tinkering around in my parents' basement or the garage, just trying to figure out how I could do it myself. There was just something so much that I loved about those Ray Harryhausen creature features and the Rankin-Bass Christmas specials and things like that. I just thought it was so cool, and it was something I was mentioning earlier. I think it's evocative of when you're a kid, that primal thing is where you're bringing a child's beloved plaything to life and the inner life that you imagine these things have. I think stop motion has that kind of quality. It has this magical charm that's difficult to find in other forms.
But
of
I mean,
media.
For you, I mean, the opportunities to get into animation, you could have gone any which way. What drew you to stop motion? What drew you to this classic historic art form and wanting to build on it for the future?
I think it's just because I'm weird. I don't know.
It's honest.
It's just so cool. I mean, I think there's really nothing like it. Now, you know, when I started getting into animation, CG didn't exist. I mean, this is back in the 80s where, you know, CG was just in its infancy at that point. But, you know, with the 90s, when I started doing this professionally, that's when we really started seeing technology in the computer in its ascendancy. And it kind of, it basically undermined every other form of animation there was. You know, hand-drawn animation started to go away. Stop motion definitely went away. And so by the time that we formed Leica 10 years ago, you know, stop motion was, you know, it was on life support, and someone was really ready to pull that plug. And so that's when we decided that this medium that we love, we've got to find a new way to reinvigorate it, to bring it to a new era. And so both in terms of our storytelling and our production techniques, we really wanted to do something new and different. And that was the beginning, and that's when we started on Coraline, and it's been, you know, ever since we've been doing this.
You know, an audience that's going to come out to your movies, families and children, kids, they're inundated with animation.
Yeah,
and, I mean,
there's a lot of it.
I mean, just think about the technology and the ability for, not just with films, but with TV and other places, to see it. So do you ever feel like you have to keep up with that for kids to feel like they're getting something that, ooh, this is the best, I've never seen this before, as opposed to, you know what, I can get this on Cartoon Network at 2 o'clock in the morning?
Well, I do think that we want to give audiences new experiences. And so, you know, we're certainly aware of what else is happening out there. And you're right, there's a ton of animation. There's more animation now than that's ever been. But I don't think there's animation like the kinds of stories that we make. I think the kinds of stories we make are very unique. The fact that we're based in Portland, Oregon, it really has allowed us to evolve independently to make this culture, you know, outside of all the major film hubs. And I think that's made us one of the things that's made us so unique. And it means that the kinds of films that we make have a unique perspective. And I think that, you know, it doesn't really matter for us what other people are doing, because we're telling, if you know, new and interesting kinds of stories in different genres. And I think people get excited by that.
Do you see a future for your company where you may change the audience, where it's not families, where you go to adult stuff, use the stop motion, the 3D, the technology that you're creating, the animation that you're creating, to try some rated R stuff?
Yeah, well, I mean, I do think I'm excited about telling different kinds of stories in different genres. I think, you know, animation sometimes gets lumped into one, you know, people see animation as a genre in and of itself.
Right.
It's really not, any more than live action is a genre. It's just a way to make a movie. It's a powerful visual medium that you can use to make a movie. And so the genres that you explore, the story that you explore within animation, I think that's really exciting. That's where you can take it into different avenues. You know, everything that we've done to this point has been geared towards family. Now, I do think that our definition of family is maybe a little broad, you know, compared to some other, sure, you know, definitions of family. And I think within that spectrum, sometimes things will be geared more towards, you know, more appropriate for younger members of the family. Sometimes it might be more older members of the family. And so I could certainly foresee us doing something that's way different than anything we've ever done before. And in fact, we're developing just that right now.
As I think about, we talk with filmmakers, and a lot of filmmakers will come on and talk about the movies made or broken in the editing room. Mm-hmm. You know, Ira Glass was just on talking about Don't Think Twice, and Mike Birbiglia's movie where it was just all about they made it all happen in the editing room.
Yeah.
For an animated film,
yeah, you can't do that.
You can't do that, right?
No,
so how
does
it work? I mean, you pretty much have to set out what you want to accomplish and execute it.
Yeah, you got to be really disciplined. I mean, we put a lot of effort early on to just getting the story and the characters right before we do any animation at all. And in fact, you make the movie before you make the movie. We do the entire film in storyboards before we shoot a single frame of the movie. And you put temp voices on there, you put temp music on there to try to see if it plays. And if it doesn't, then you'll rework things in storyboards. And that's the way you can shoot coverage and quote unquote find it in the edit bay is by, you know, doing it in storyboards before you actually go out and shoot it. But once you're committed to shooting it, that's it. You can't shoot, you know, everything that you shoot is going in the movie.
Does that make it harder as a filmmaker in 2016 to not only be able to do this kind of work, but to recruit the kind of people that want to do this kind of work? Because filmmaking is now changed in the way that you can go into an editing room, you can change, you can fix the problem. This is a much more dialed in, specific kind of art form.
I think it just requires extraordinary discipline. And it's just, you know, on the one hand, it's incredible imagination because you're imagining these entire worlds. You're bringing these things to life in new and interesting ways. And so that's really exciting. On the other hand, you have to balance that with this amazing discipline where you know exactly what you're going to do and you structure it and organize it in a way that you can actually pull these things off. You know, particularly when you're trying to do these things for a budget. I mean, our films are a fraction of the cost of, you know, say a Pixar or a DreamWorks film or something like that. And so we got to make sure that we're putting all our resources on the screen, that we're not wasting it. And so we do that. I think that a place like Leica and a place like Portland, where we're based, it draws the same kind of person. People that are a little weird, people that are a little, you know, left to center, people are kind of like, you know, Portland is kind of an island of misfit toys anyway. And we're an island within the island of misfit toys. And so I think it can be hard to recruit some people, but I think people are naturally drawn to what we do based on, you know, their awareness of what we do.
The director of Kubo and the Two Strings, Travis Knight, my guest tonight, Kubo and the Two Strings will be in theaters this weekend. He's also the CEO of Leica, the production company in Portland, Oregon. Keep making great films. Congratulations on the success of this film, and we hope to talk to you sometime again.
Thank you.
There are the monsters of the Midwest rolling across the USA. They're the monsters of the Midwest. The monsters have come to play.
Classic. That's a classic right there, Pete Zimmerman. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, according to Adam Hoge, the Bears look a lot better on day two in New England. He's covering the team as they do their split practice with the Patriots. Adam Hoge joins us now. Get all his stuff at WGNradio.com/Bears. Adam, how's it going?
Good. Just enjoying a nice dinner at one of the greatest places in America, the Union Oyster House in Boston.
All right. There you go.
Highly recommend it to anybody. But, yeah, the Bears had a much better day. I'm not willing to say that my concerns about, you know, especially their offense, which have been ongoing and were certainly on display against the Broncos last week in the first preseason game. I'm not willing to say that those are all completely gone away because of one practice, but yesterday here, the first practice against the Patriots, it was very, very obvious that one of the teams was better than the other. Obviously the New England Patriots, who happen to be a perennial Super Bowl contender. Today, things, though, reversed a little bit, and the Bears responded. They were able to move the ball on offense, which was encouraging. I thought that Alshon Jeffery and Kevin White, we don't get to see them out there on the field together a whole lot, and they both looked really, really good.
That's great to hear, because that's one thing that we want to see from the Denver game to the New England game, is just a bounce back, a rebound, to show some resolve to get up when knocked down. So it's nice to see that in day two of the practice they seem to show that.
Yeah, and these have been competitive, grueling practices. The Patriots, yeah, I don't know how to say this without sounding like it's a knock on the Bears, because it's really not. Every team runs things differently. But as you could probably imagine for Bill Belichick, he runs a pretty tight ship. Mm-hmm. And you know, he's got his team running up a hill at the end of practice after they've been going for 2 hours of hitting each other with pads. He says, all right, time to go over this hill and do wind sprints. And, you know, John Fox has basically been going along and saying, hey, we're doing New England Patriot practices this week. And so they had to do it too. So these have been pretty grueling practices, a lot of tempers flaring, no major fights. I mean, the thing yesterday with Alshon Jeffery and Malcolm Butler was, you know, a lot was made out of it because they got kicked out of practice, not necessarily because of what happened. And some guys were kicked out today, too. Brian Stork, the Patriots center, got tossed for trying to swing and throw a punch. And Harold Jones.
Who tosses people? Is that like the refs there?
It's the coaches.
Oh, the coaches.
No. It's Belichick saying bye. And Belichick has this rule all the time. Belichick does not put up with this stuff. The stuff that was happening in Bourbonnais a couple weeks ago with the Bears. I think Fox was allowing it to happen because, you know, we had this conversation when I was in Bourbonnais. This was a team that needs to show some toughness, and that has been an issue in the past. But once the brawl at Family Fest at Soldier Field happened, John Fox said, okay, enough is enough. And you heard Jay Cutler say, too, that, all right, we're kind of becoming a dumb team now, and there's a fine line between tough and dumb, and you can't let that spill over to the regular season because then you start becoming the Detroit Lions from a few years ago that was having, you know, they would have personal foul penalties every other play, and that's not what you want. So this is a tough situation in Foxborough this week when you're going up against another team, but you got to keep your emotions in check. And these coaches have been, you know, been pretty strict. Any nonsense, you're out. The only difference is that Belichick sends his guys to the locker room right away. Fox keeps them on the sideline.
All right, let's talk about the sideline, a little drama. Martellus Bennett, of course, the former Bear tight end, now with the New England Patriots. A lot of media there to talk to him today because, obviously, of the comments he made to ESPN about Jay Cutler. He got a little creative, didn't he?
Yeah, Martellus is a pretty smart guy. He's pretty calculated in what he does, and he usually has a pretty good grasp on situations. So I don't know that he comes out of today looking good for dodging the media when he makes those comments about Jay Cutler in the ESPN the magazine story earlier this month and basically, you know, talks some smack about him and says that you wouldn't throw him the ball when he was open. I mean, if you're going to do that, you have to answer when the Chicago Bears media comes to town. And so far he's ducked us. And I thought today was interesting because he's smart. He knows we're there. He knows we want to talk to him. He knew that for 20 minutes while he played with his daughter on the field, that there were probably over 100 media members because the Patriots have a huge media contingency and they were all there wanting to talk to him too. We were all waiting and he knew that. We were all standing there right by the field. And he's playing with his daughter, and all the cameras are on him playing with his daughter. He knows this. And at the end of the day, when he decides to just walk by us once he got done playing. So, you know, I think it's calculated. Maybe I'm wrong.
He just seems to be the guy who just kind of likes to mess with the media. He has been doing that for a while now.
Maybe I'm giving him too much credit, but I felt – and we covered him closely for 3 years. I was there every day. I feel like I have a pretty good grasp of Martellus Bennett. This was all premeditated and calculated.
Of course.
At the end of the day, there's no dumb comments about Jay Cutler. He didn't have to talk about him. And all there is out there are television shots and photographs all over social media
playing with the family,
of him playing with his daughter.
And John Fox came over there, so it looks like they're all cozy. Yeah,
exactly. So I'm trying to give him some credit here. Am I annoyed that he ducked us? Yes, I'm annoyed personally, but I'm also trying to give him some maybe a little bit of sarcasm in here, but give him some credit for what he did.
Yeah, at least he's being creative with it. All right, let's get back to the field. Good things out of the defensive line. Hakeem Nicks came over in the trade free agent from New England. He has been impressive. But today especially, he seemed to do a good job on the field, but he also had a big hit on Martellus Bennett, which we love here in Chicago.
Yeah, and this is something I kind of hinted at in what I wrote today on WGRadio.com because I haven't really been able to get any players to, you know, come out and say, oh, yeah, we're we're targeting Martellus to back up our quarterback, which even if they did say that, I don't think that's a bad thing to say and admit, but I get the feeling watching these two practices the last 2 days that there's a little extra juice in the defense when it comes to Marty, because they know what he said about Jay, and I think they're trying to send a little bit of a message. They've been very physical with him to the point that they can be based on the practice rules. But, you know, Akeem Hicks had a pretty solid hit on Marty today. And hit's not the right word, because it was more just a pancake block, but he got him really good. It was a clean football play. A little bit later, Lamar Houston, though, and him got in a little bit of a wrestling match, and Marty ended up on the ground with his helmet off. And those two have a history. Even when they were on the Bears together, there was an incident between them and OTAs a couple years ago, which OTAs you don't even have pads on. So that was pretty well documented. And they used to jaw each other a lot, practices. And there was an incident between them yesterday and then today. So there's obviously a rivalry going on there between Marty and Lamar Houston. And Lamar Houston's pretty tight with Jay Cutler, too. So that's I think there's a little extra in there this week in what Marty said about Jay. And I think that's cool. I think that's cool for the Bears to stick up for their quarterback.
Yeah, it's great to hear, right?
And I wanted to talk to Lamar. He didn't want to talk to the media today. Speaking of guys that, you know, refused to talk to us, Lamar Houston didn't talk to us today either. But I actually think it would be cool and completely fair if they did talk to us and he said, yeah, I don't like what he said about my quarterback. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
He's growing on me, Lamar Houston. You know, he had a bad first year when he got hurt doing a sack dance against these New England Patriots. But but last year he played well when we needed someone to step up, and I like to see that he's personally sending
he's a
message
guy.
To Marty Bennett. We'll take that. We'll take that. Yeah. All right, on the other side, let's talk offense. Zach Miller, you know, the coach says there's nothing to his knee. It's not a setback, but there's thoughts that Zach Miller's still going through the concussion protocol, that either he had a setback or he's continuing to recover from a concussion.
Yeah, John Fox's words today were a little bit mixed, because, you know, he said there wasn't a setback, and yet we know he was cleared from the concussion protocol because he talked to us. And you're not allowed to talk to the media until you're cleared, and he talked to us twice. He talked to us Saturday, he talked to us Monday. But they have been easing him out there. He did a lot yesterday in practice, but wasn't completely full go. So, you know, I don't know. Maybe John Fox doesn't want to call it a setback, but it's not only weird that he then didn't practice today, but he went and saw a doctor this morning.
Right.
That's what John Fox said. And they got stuck in traffic coming back, so it's not like he was seeing – some kind of, you know, team doctor that was just holding them up in the locker room or something. So I don't really know the specifics there. As you know, Fox is pretty elusive when it comes to specifics and injuries. But I did find that situation with Zach Miller a little bit odd today. Again, nothing concerning that the guy's going to be out a long time. But for somebody who has injury history at a position that's so thin for the Bears right now, a tight end, you want to see Zach Miller out
there. Yeah, you really do, because, I mean, especially against Martellus Bennett and the Patriots, who we gave up.
Yeah.
All right, so the last thing here and the last nugget you had in your coverage today was about the Bears doing a lot of talking. They're doing celebrations.
Yeah.
They're talking at practice. They're jawing. Is this something we can expect from this defense and this offense, to be a little bit more jumpy, a little bit more trash-talky kind of a football team?
Yeah, and I don't know that they were necessarily trash talking as much as they were just going nuts about, you know, touchdowns for backups in a practice against a team and a franchise like the Patriots, which is so businesslike and methodical and professional. Not that the Bears aren't professional, but it just, you know, yesterday when the Patriots were beating up on the Bears in practice, they weren't going nuts. They weren't celebrating. They were acting like they're the Patriots. They've been here before. Today almost to me had a vibe of like, if like the White Sox were to have like a huge walk-off, which, yeah, God forbid that ever happened. But if they did, had a big walk-off home run and they went nuts like they won the World Series, and in reality, they're having an awful season. you know, that kind of deal that you get sometimes in like September with a bad baseball team. That's almost what it felt like today. It's just like, I don't know, be careful what you ask for, because you know, Bill Belichick, and this was more of a joke than anything, but he, you know, he might just run up the score on Thursday night if he gets the opportunity, even though it's a preseason game.
As you say, watch out. You might just get Tom Brady for the whole game.
Yeah.
Is Brady running the offense there? Is he, I mean, he's suspended for the first four games, but is he running all the first team stuff?
You know, he's basically splitting carries or reps with the first team offense for the Patriots, and they're letting Jimmy Garoppolo, who, by the way, I'd like a lot. I think Jimmy's I liked him coming out of Eastern Illinois.
Of course, right.
And I haven't seen him in a couple of years since before the draft, you know, up like this up close. And he's really gotten better, too. So I think Jimmy, whether it's with the Patriots or with another team, because he's already entering his third year, and the Patriots are going to have to make a decision here in the next couple of years with him, I think he's going to have a decent NFL career. But to answer your question, they're kind of splitting carries right now because, on one hand, you want to keep Brady fresh. But on the other, you got to get Jimmy Garoppolo ready to play his first four games because, you know, at a minimum, you want to win two of them. I think they're going to be okay, though. I think the Patriots are probably going to get out of these first 4 weeks with probably three wins.
There you go. Adam Hoge, WGN Radio Sports, covering the Bears in New England. Thanks for checking in. You can check his work at WGNRadio.com/Bears. Thanks, Adam.
All right. Thanks, Justin.
It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up at 10 o'clock tonight, it's the worst. Every Tuesday night, we complain about the worst things in society for prizes. And we've got some great prizes. This is awesome. I just looked at this in the break. We have a pair of tickets to an afternoon with Priscilla Presley at the Paramount Theater. So you can call in, or you can call in or text and say how much you know, it's the worst is standing in line at the grocery store, and boom. You're seeing Priscilla Presley. You're hanging out with Priscilla Presley. I don't know if there's a hangout involved, but you know what? I get you there. You do the hangout. You figure it out. I got a great story about my brother who one time, and this is a great family story, he went to see the band Oasis, which was at Chicago Theater, and he was a big fan. And afterwards, the tour buses are on the side right there on Lake Street. He's at the Chicago Theater. And he was standing next to some guy came up and goes, "Hey, the tour bus, I just saw the tour bus combination to get on the thing is 1123 if you want to get on the bus." And my brother, it was the ripe age of 19 or something like that, decided 1122. And the door opened, and he walked onto the Oasis bus. And so he went to the back of the bus, and there was Liam and Noel and all the guys, and they were, like, playing cards and relaxing. And they looked up, and they're like, "Who are you?" And he's like, "Hey, don't freak out. I'm not crazy." Like, that's how he tells it. "I'm not crazy. I just want to say I love you guys. Great show." And then I think it was Liam who was just like, "So let me get this straight. You're just a bugger off the street that just somehow got on our tour bus." And he's like, "Yep." And he's like, "All right." They just turned their head. And in a minute, security lifted him like pretty much off his feet, off the bus, and he was kicked out. Anyway, so I don't think you should do that with Priscilla Presley, but that's... that's what I'm saying. You can get there. So that's coming up at 10 o'clock. Kristen Toomey and Adam Burke, two great Chicago comedians, will be joining us for the worst. I'm excited. 312-981-7200. All right. But this hour, is there anything better than Shakespeare in the Park? I don't know what is, but the Bard with a nice breeze at your back. Come on. So nice. And it's tradition. So if you're looking for a weekend getaway, the American Players Theater in Spring Green, Wisconsin, showing King Lear through the end of September. December would be a long time. We also get cold up there, right? The play returns to the Hill in Spring Green. It's directed by Chicago director William Brown. Brown's no stranger to the outdoor series. He's directed 18 productions in Spring Green. William has directed all over Chicago, including the Writers Theater, Timeline, Northlight. He's acted in several roles as well, including Ebenezer Scrooge in The Goodman's Christmas Carol. He's won Jeff Awards, and he was named Chicagoan of the Year by the Trib back in 2003. William Brown, welcome to the download. Good to see you.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So let's talk about this. I mean, King Lear, this is your 18th production. What is it about the American Players Theater that keeps bringing you back?
There's a couple things. It is a magical place. I'm not kidding about that. You park down at the bottom of a hill. The audience parks at the bottom of a hill, and they climb up through the woods to a natural amphitheater that seats 1,100 people. And there's and a stage that does more than it's supposed to, and lights and costumes and some of the best actors I've worked with. But that's not all. I think one of the things that keeps bringing me back is how smart, how receptive, how what ownership this audience has. They climbed up that hill. They own the play you're about to do.
Well, it's a interesting tradition for Chicago theater artists, directors, performers, costume designers to be a part of this.
Yep.
This experience in Spring Green. It's almost something you have to do if you're going to be in Chicago theater. But I've heard so many stories, friends of mine who have gone and done that run. It's important. There's something special about its connection to Chicago.
Yeah, it is. It's only about 3.5 hours away from downtown Chicago. There's a number of actors, designers, directors who work up there. I kid myself, it's my summer home. I don't really have a home up there, but I stay in the same apartment every summer and I pretend. And, you know, everybody's there for one thing. No one's going to get rich and famous working in Spring Green, Wisconsin. We're there for the work. And there's a real commitment to whether it's Shakespeare or Shaw or Stoppard or Arthur Miller. There's a real commitment to the work, to the words, to the truth of it all. It is a very, very happy home for me, and I'm grateful for it.
For you, I mean, to read off your resume is a who's who of Chicago theater. I mean, for you, how much of it is the experience, rejuvenating experience for you? I mean, because you work constantly in this town. You've produced, you've directed, you're all over the place. I mean, what's the spiritual connection to leaving this town to go to do theater in the park in Spring Green, Wisconsin?
It is spiritual. It is, you know, we have a tradition when the lights come down and before the curtain call starts to leave the lights out long enough to see the moon, to see the stars. Sometimes the moon is so bright, it lights up the entire theater. And the place has a kind of, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright, Taliesin is there. There's some spiritual, I'm not kidding, kind of vibe that all of us feel. And I think the people that come and bring their picnics and picnic before the show, and they get that too. It is a very loyal audience. They get their tickets as soon as they go on sale in the winter. It is spiritual.
Well, it's not the.
It's not the city.
It's not. Yeah, but yeah. It's not the only place that does theater in the park. I mean, you can catch it here in Chicago and
sure
parks.
Can.
You can check in some suburban locations. Mm-hmm. What is it about this place, 3.5 hours away in Spring Green, Wisconsin, that sort of captures everybody's interest?
It has a tremendous core company of actors who have been there for years, for decades even. They are still hungry. They still want to risk and challenge themselves. And it's every year we're joined by people, some just out of school or actors that we haven't had a chance to work with before. There is one goal. It is to do that play. And there's something about the relationship, the older I get, the more aware I am of the relationship between those of us that do plays and the audience. Mm-hmm. And it is honored there. They'll let us know if we're bad, but they're always game. I think one of the first Shaw. It was a big deal to suddenly do Shaw. Well, they loved it. So it's a regular part of our. We added American Classics. I did another part of The Forest. And other people have done this production of Death of a Salesman. Will knock your socks off.
So that's important. I mean, there's not it's just one. Important. I mentioned King Lear, but there are 9 productions that are done throughout the summertime, all the way to October.
Oscar Wilde, Comedy of Errors, The Stoppard is Arcadia, Death of a Salesman.
And to see these same actors,
you know, attack Shakespeare. It's in rep. See Shakespeare attacked one night, and then Willie Loman the next night with the same intensity, with the same chops. It's thrilling.
William Brown's my guest tonight, a great Chicago director. His King Lear is up at the in Spring Green, Wisconsin, at the American Players Theater. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll continue and talk about what it is. I mean, for you as a director, the differences between directing a play that's outdoors and a play that might be right here at Timeline.
Right.
We'll talk with more with William Brown here right on The Download. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN Chicago. I'm Justin Kaufman. We're talking about the tradition of Shakespeare in the Park, Theater in the Park, Spring Green, Wisconsin, American Players Theater. In studio with me now, director William Brown, who's done 18 different productions in Spring Green. He's doing King Lear, which is on stage there in rep till September 30th. Okay, so I'm fascinated by, you've directed a ton of stuff. I read your bio at the top, some of it, just a sliver of it. But you've done so many things here in town, and you've done 18 productions in Spring Green. What is the difference, and what are some of the challenges about doing theater outdoors as opposed to in a traditional theater?
Well, the first thing is weather. It could rain. It could snow. I've done plays in Montana when it snowed. I actually have done outdoors. The first gig I ever had was an actor in an outdoor play when I was 17. So I've kind of honed my chops. And then I end up working at Timeline and Writers back when Writers was 50 seats. So a good play is a good play. But there is a certain amount of perspective. The architecture has to be a little hardier outside.
Right.
And I'm not just saying, you know, the sets and costumes, but we used to say, and I toured Montana for a number of years, and someone would always say, you have to be more interesting than the guy throwing a Frisbee to his dog. And that's not a bad way to live.
That's not a bad way to live.
That's
right.
Not a that's bad a, way to think of
a,
your
that,
art.
Yeah, that's not. That's just a good life thing. The mm-hmm. life lesson there. Mm-hmm. But okay, so let's talk about. I keep saying Shakespeare in the Park, and I said at the top, Shakespeare in the Park. There's something about it.
Right.
The bard and the wind and everything involved is just so magical. You have done both. You've done all sorts. Well, let's first talk about Shakespeare. I mean, Shakespeare. It almost feels like Shakespeare is the go-to for theater outside.
Right. It was originally done outside at the Globe. So it feels right. You can do the Fields of France, or you can do, you know, it allows for a certain largeness of gesture. Certainly the language will take you, you know, will never live up to the language fully, but there is something. And Americans love Shakespeare outdoors. All over the country, you know, it's an event that's become part of an American tradition.
You know, as a director, when you read that text and you adapt and you put plays on stage, can you feel that these were performed outdoors? I mean, are there cues that say this is a play that is for a stage outside?
I mean, I've also done these plays like, you know, at Writers Theatre in right, smaller right. spaces. What it does require is a theater that's malleable, that's allows us to go from Cleopatra's Egypt to Navarre to the Forest of Arden to, you know, I mean, and because we're in rep, we don't do entire sets. We have to be very smart about how we use the space. But Shakespeare does so much of the heavy lifting, you know, that language can make you believe you're anywhere, anytime.
For you, I mean, let's take to the next level where, you know, what about other kinds of play? The American classics you mentioned, Death
right.
of a Salesman. I mean, plays like that, do they translate well to outside, to an audience that's sitting outdoors?
I think so. I mean, certainly the ones we've done, the first one I did was Night of the Iguana, and you know, we talked about it for years. The heat of a Wisconsin August, it feels like you're in Acapulco. And all the animal sounds and all the trees, and the trees cover the stage. So it wasn't very hard to put a little inn, a Mexican inn there. And my sound designer, Andy Hansen, who almost always does my sound design, said he was going to put some jungle animals in into the soundscape. And one night in tech, I went over to him and said, I think you've gone too far. I think that's too many weird animals. And he said, I haven't put any animals in it. It's just the animals we have.
Just what's around, right? That's something you have to deal with, right? It's the environment, right?
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I get a question about how these, I mean, a lot of it is idyllic. A lot of it is romantic and sort of a connection to the space and to the town that they live or that's something they an audience will travel to. And like you said, take that sort of almost pilgrimage up the hill.
Yep.
How much will that audience take in terms of experimentation? How much, you know, in the idea of trying something that might be a little bit more, you know, acquired taste?
I have yet to see the limits of that. They come, they're game. They come ready to play. We're doing a Sarah Rule play this year. I did Tom Stoppard's Travesties, not the easiest play for anyone to digest, and they fell out of their chairs laughing. They enjoyed it thoroughly. We have yet to see the limits of what they're willing to explore.
For you, you're back in town now, so mm-hmm. So is it tough to leave? I mean, is it tough, like, you finished, you directed it, King Lear is now going. I mean, is it for you, is it tough to sort of to come back to Chicago after having that experience in Spring Green?
I love my life. I'm just going to be up front. And I have a wonderful time there, and I get fresh eggs, and I know where to get the best chickens. And, I mean, I have a whole infrastructure of my own based largely on food. But at the same token, I'm back and I can order Thai food now. So yeah, I'm grateful for that.
So now you make a transition. I mean, the next plays, you'll be indoors. So uh-huh. Talk about that. Talk about, you know, the vibrancy of, like you just said, you love your life.
Right.
The idea of being able to be a theater artist in this region.
Yes.
And be able to go from, yes. You know, doing stuff outdoors in Spring Green, Wisconsin, coming in and doing plays at Writers. I mean, there's a lot of options for you as yes. a director in this town.
In this region, you said it. It is such a fertile, alive, lively, exciting place to do theater. And I guess I'm extending it to the larger Chicago area, but it is the audience. I mean, they come ready to play, and you go to these little storefronts, you go to the Goodman, it's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's all taken seriously, you know. There's not a even the critics.
That's
go to they all I feel that that I don't know of another place where so much theater is indulged.
Well, I mean, that's something that I have a lot of conversations with theater artists on this program, and we talk about it. And a lot of times we'll say, what makes Chicago theater different?
Yeah.
Rarely, if ever, have I heard somebody say, well, the audiences. Or the audiences interact or engage differently than other places. Or possibly that the lifeblood for this is the audience. And so it's interesting. So talk more about the idea of a Chicago audience as compared to other places.
I work and I go see theater, and rarely is someone dragged to the theater. Rarely is someone there because it's a corporate account or it's the hip thing to do. I mean, unless I'm missing out on the hip things to do.
There's a couple hot new theaters.
Yeah, right. But you know, the loyalty that so many of these theaters have that goes back decades. And it is, perhaps it is a chicken or egg. I guess we do a kind of theater that is personal. I mean, I always think about how improv and story theater started here. And I long before I came here, but it was part of my earliest training. And when I got here, I felt it was in the water. Mm-hmm. I felt that the kind of thing that happens in an improv is what we're all trying to do with scripted material.
We find that moment.
Yeah,
right, right.
And not know how it's going to end.
Right.
And it's rare, but it's the goal. And I think that's why so much theater in Chicago is so lively for alive.
Well, you mentioned that loyalty. I mean, the loyalty to the audience is one thing, but loyalty to the other actors and directors involved. I mean, America's when you're doing American Players Theater in Spring Green, Wisconsin, talk about that, because that's such an arduous and rewarding process to spend time with other theater artists,
right,
creating something, right, in a sort of confined space where, right, you know, they're not going back to their, you know, neighborhood, right, or somewhere, right, else, but, right, but there really is this camaraderie, this ensemble that has created that. That's, it's almost like summer camp.
It is. It is. Yeah. It is a camaraderie. It is. You know, rep is the kindest form of theater you can do. Yes, you'll play King Lear one night, and then you may have a night off,
right?
And then the next night you'll play the grumpy old father in The Ideal Husband. It's just. It's so doable. You can give 100% every night because you're not doing 8 Lears a week.
Right,
dear,
right,
God.
That's good. What keeps you here? What keeps you in Chicago? I mean, you have such an esteemed career here. You know, the theaters that I've mentioned, you played Scrooge for years at the Goodman. So, like, what keeps you here?
Nowhere else on earth, nowhere else in this country, at least, could I have the career I have. I've never gotten stuck playing one kind of role as an actor. I've never gotten stuck directing one kind of play. I do Shakespeare. I do new plays. I do classics. I do Stoppard. I'm doing musicals now. Who gets to do that?
That's true, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. And I love this city. I grew up in West Virginia. Lived in New York. Lived in San Francisco. But I gradually fell in love with this city, and now I just can't think of another place I'd rather be.
Are you already looking ahead to the 19th production next year in
there's
Spring
talk,
Green?
There's, yeah, talk. There's talk. Yeah. I'm sure I'm not supposed to announce that. But
there's been talks.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
But it's you know, it's not Shakespeare. It's, you know, it's something else. And yeah.
There you go. William Brown is a director in town. He's so many credits from the Writers Theater, Timeline, Northlight, acted in several roles, including Ebenezer Scrooge and The Goodman's Christmas Carol. He's won Jeff Awards. He's been Chicagoan of the Year by the Tribune in 2003. And he is the director of King Lear, which is in rep at the American Players Theater in Spring Green, Wisconsin. It's running till September 30th. I think the rep goes through October. But William, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks
for talking about theater in Chicago. We appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
It's a download here, WGN Radio. I saw today they did a seventh inning stretch of the first doubleheader game where they went to the video screen and did Ernie Banks. They do that a lot, Pete? Is that something they do a lot?
Yeah. Yeah, they go to the, like, they do Santo, Harry, Banks.
I just, you know, as much as, you know, Ernie Banks is a huge icon, Santo as well.
Mm-hmm.
Seventh inning stretch is Harry's thing, man. You know, he did it by himself for years. We talked about this, it was a year ago now. We had somebody on who actually was putting a petition around to make Harry Carey do the video seventh inning stretch, and here's a perfect they're doing it. I just don't. What is it? What is it that they would not just commit to doing that in the seventh inning stretch every time with Harry Carey on the board? It would go. I mean, it'd be larger than life. Is there some sort of royalty issue involved? They don't want to pay for the likeness of Harry Carey?
No, I think they want to mix it up.
You guys would do that, right? Guys outside, of course, they got thumbs up. Like, everyone would go to Wrigley Field, and they'd be like, I would love to see the video of Harry Carey over, I don't know, the latest star of the sitcom.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, for sure. I think they should get away with all people, all celebrities, whatever. I don't, you know, even Eddie Vedder, you know, he's a Cubs fan. I don't, you know, Joe Montana, Bill Peterson, you know, they're classic Cub fans. I understand that. Right. But, yeah, do Harry Caray if you're going to, yeah, commit to Harry Caray. And I guess I'm fine with Ernie Banks and Ron Santo.
I forgot last year in the playoffs, did they put on a lot of celebrities in the playoffs? Was it Vetter and was the lineup, like, so predictable?
Yeah, I can't remember. Yeah, I can't remember either.
They only had, I mean, they played some games.
Yeah, they played games. I can't remember. I was watching over the weekend.
They didn't really, they don't show it. That's why when they get to the Fox, they don't
show. That's true.
It.
Yeah, yeah. They might like later on.
Yeah,
like all right,
here.
We saw. Right. I was watching the documentary on the Bartman Ball for some reason on Sunday morning.
The one from ESPN.
Yeah,
that is such a
catching hell
hard thing to watch because I think, and there were a lot of articles when that came out too about the same feeling. It's a very dark time in Chicago. It's the feel. Like in that the footage in that documentary that's on the ground, that's actually in the park, not the stuff that they show on television, is just super scary.
It's
scary.
Frightening.
Frightening scary.
You don't realize how in peril Steve Bartman was for his life when you hear some of these people talking about how angry they were. And
that sound, I mean, because they took video from a bunch of different people in the stadium at that time or at Wrigley Field. Yeah, that was crazy. That scared me. It scared me. It made me reaffirm my belief that, or reaffirm my identity as a Sox fan. Like when I saw that, I was like,
I know. And they,
I'm like, yeah, I don't want to be a part of this.
Like, they talked to people who said they'd like on camera that were not like part of like,
yeah, right.
They talked to the guy separately, like in like a bar or whatever, like in street clothes after the incident. And he was fine with saying that he threatened Steve Bartman. But anyway, I kind of forgot about the whole hubbub about Bernie Mac singing the seven. I was at that game, actually.
You were at the Bartman game?
I was at the Bartman game.
Wow.
Walked home to my house in Wicker Park. I was so sad, like Charlie Brown or Lioness or whatever, a Peanut character.
You got to be kidding me.
No.
Yeah. You walked all the way home.
All the way home. But okay. they kind of blamed, in the documentary, they blamed Bernie Mac for singing the seventh inning stretch because he said, root, root, root for the champions.
Oh, he didn't say Cubbies. Cubs. Anything they could find.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Anything they could find. Except for the fact that shortstop didn't catch the ball for a double play. Would have been out of it.
I feel that watching that document, I don't even know why I was watching it. I don't know, just like ESPN. I was like, what's on ESPN?
Yeah, yeah.
And that was it. But I don't think the Cubs this year, I don't think they're going to fall prey to the same. I don't think Joe Madden's going to allow that.
And I didn't feel any of that last year, to be honest. Like, they got beat. They didn't get beat because of some curse, and they didn't beat because, oh, God, like that. Oh, here it goes again. What you're seeing right now is just sheer dominance. I mean, there are teams, we talked about this before, that there are teams, the 84 Cubs come to mind, the 84 Tigers especially. Every year there's a team that kind of runs away with it, and only in history there's a few times when that team doesn't go all the way. You know, you think about the New England Patriots getting knocked off in the Super Bowl, or maybe the Seattle Mariners who had 120 wins. But most times in the major sports, if you're running away with it, you've got a great chance. The percentage of you winning is pretty high. And you think that, I mean, this Cubs team reminds me of a 90s Packers team, you know, where they were going 13-3, 14-2. They just have that vibe where they're essentially blowing people out. I mean, this is not even this game right now. This is the second game in a row against this Brewers team. And I joked at the top of the show, Braun's out of this game. He had a knee injury. So who's left?
Yeah. Scooter Gannett.
They're not even putting
a real guy.
Fight. But, did you see that Anthony Rizzo jumped into the stands? And, I mean, there's just something about it, man. This team is really, really strong. It's really fun to watch. It's a really fun team to root for.
And, they're not going to lose because of any – they're going to lose if they have to – they go up against a couple of good pitchers and they don't hit during the – you know, that's how they're going to lose.
That's baseball, right?
Yeah.
But they're not going to lose because of some freak play.
No,
that's just not what they do.
Not because, you know, John Cusack is the wrong team when he's up there singing. Piven.
What I love is that what we'll get from the celebrities is the new show, Raining Hard. Raining Hard with Vin Diesel. He's at the park.
Hey, how you doing?
That's right. So
that is what you get in the playoffs, right? You know, sixth inning where they cut to and maybe they're behind the camera. They used to do that. where they would like be operating the camera. Oh, look at that! It's the guy from Prison Break coming back, season three of Prison Break.
Yeah.
They need to do a better job of like that kind of cross promotion.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what we could do here at the Download is figure out, you know, because I really want to sink my teeth into a new segment. We've done it with Mary Sue Barrett from Metropolitan Planning Council, and it's been great. But it's been very things that are wrong with the government or more sort of lofty ideas. We did one on actual government. How do you fix government? I think we did one on transportation.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to do another one tomorrow on the Chicago River. But I want to get into, like, how do you fix how do you improve grocery stores? How do you improve cable television?
Hmm.
How do you improve banking? You know, like the things
like everyday things that everyday, people have.
How do you improve,
like when the worst, you know, people complain about
getting on a plane. Like those kind of things. It's hard for me and you because we got to find the right guest to do that, and it might not be someone that's you know like right here. But I think that our listeners at home would have something to say about that. Like I want to do in this case, how do you improve cross promotion on a baseball game?
I on Saturday I was watching the game and we were out watching it because we went to a bar because we wanted to watch. There's a lot of sports. There's the Olympics on, so we.
How do you improve the Olympics?
You look up on the TV. The Cubs are there. It's Len and JD and Cheryl Scott. Because the game was on ABC.
And so they were...
So they were talking to her about the weather, apparently. I don't even know. I wasn't listening. But, and like, you know, Rob Belgus has done it. And I like both of them quite a bit.
Right,
and I'm sure they probably feel awkward doing it.
Yeah, it's weird.
You know?
It seems like there would be a better way to do cross-promotion to enhance your brand. You know? Like, I mean, I think that there's a possibility to
do
that. You know? I just think that... I think we have a savvy listenership, and I think that they would be up for and on the up and up with something that was just a little bit more, okay, this is tongue-in-cheek, we get it. Like, I feel that idea, like, coming back, like, because it's tradition to be like, look who's here, it's the star of blah, blah, blah. It's just, it's so tired and stale. Who would do that? And I feel like that's just no one putting any thought into it whatsoever. You know,
yeah. Let's solve these problems.
See, that's what I mean. I think we do it once a week. We do it on Tuesday nights. You know, it's 7:30. How to improve? How to improve? Dot dot dot. How to improve? Colons. 708. Steve Cochran just did a segment saying he hates that it's always Harry Carey. LOL.
Why?
I don't know. I'd love to talk to him about it, but. You know,
should I give him a call? He might be sleeping.
No, he's totally sleeping. Yeah. But you're right. I mean, it's
why
I just think you commit to it, and it's always Harry Carey, and that's the bit. I think you do that instead of the celebrities. I'm not a big fan of celebrities. I feel like that's how do you improve it. You improve the ballpark experience by doubling down on tradition. Tradition is Harry Carey. You can do a lot of great things with the video to make it look like it's almost hologram it. I think we're seeing Wrigley Field is such a great, amazing experience. They've added the DJ. You saw the DJ from Gaff this week with Aroldis Chapman.
Uh-huh.
You know, how do you improve that? I mean, maybe we could do a whole thing on how to improve the baseball-going experience.
And having gone to games, I enjoy the Harry Carey video more than, you know, like, you know, the country singer that's playing at the Windy City Smokehouse, you know.
I'm
sure other people might like that, but I'd stick to Harry. Although I will say that when the video that they show of Harry Carey is a night game, and they should find a better
day game. See, that's what I'm saying. Like,
they should find a day game.
They need to find
for,
ways for that to be almost a flexible video.
Don't you? I mean, how many videos of Harry? Do you only have one?
Yeah, there's
6,000
videos. Put your hands together for Sean Hayes. Take me out to. Like, nobody wants that, right? And I feel bad for, you know, ladies and gentlemen, the cast, the $1 Million Quartet.
Yeah.
They're also like, oh, thanks for the. They get to keep those jerseys. They probably get to keep the jerseys, right? Coming up, Kristen Toomey and Adam Burke, two great Chicago comics in studio to help us with the worst tonight. I'm excited. I love doing the worst. It's such a good, fun thing to do. 312-981-7200. It's where we complain about the worst things in our society for prizes. You can't go wrong. Last week was a ton of fun. It was so... and the week before, when Jen Bosworth and Elizabeth Gomez were here and they were talking about the laundry... They hid and they waited. There's a lot of good stuff out there. I'm looking forward to it. It's always fun to mix it up with the listeners on the worst. 312-981-7200. I have the worst. My worst is all about washer and dryers, though. So skip that, right? Speaking of laundry, did you see the story of Bill Leff and Wendy Snyder today? That Bill Leff, there was a big story he had last week, and it was a funny story where he got ink on his pants.
Yeah.
And then there were a bunch of WGN listeners calling in on how to help him.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it was so funny that, you know, there was a follow-up to it. I was in the car, and I was like, oh, a follow-up to the story I heard earlier about his pants. And it turns out that he put his hand in his pocket after he got him back. He's like, they got the stain out. It's great. And there was a ring. It was like a diamond ring in the pocket. And he's like, wait. And then he looked down. He's like, these aren't my pants. He didn't even know they were his pants. They gave him the wrong pants.
So they gave him the pants. He took them home and put them on.
Didn't even think about it.
Yeah. Why would you?
I don't know. I know my pants. Don't you know your pants, your jeans?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, if it's similar, I guess I know my jeans, but maybe, I don't know. I don't wear my shorts that often. So, I don't know. I could probably make that mistake. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I probably could too. But it's a funny story to be able
That's
to
That's hilarious. Yeah. I think you can see the podcast is up at WGNradio.com. I have to listen to that. I always find it funny when I go to my dry cleaner and I see other people's clothes there and I see people's jerseys, like a Cubs jersey. I'm like, you care that much about the jersey to get it pressed?
I'm amazed at all the gingham at mine. Like, it's just like when they hit the thing and it goes around and you're just like, everyone's shirt looks the same. I'm just like, oh God, can I just get a shirt that's got a wild, like my buddy Dennis Rodkin, who writes for Cranes.
Yeah, yeah,
he's
yeah.
got the greatest shirts, these weird,
yeah, yeah.
weird patterned rayon shirts. And I'm like, he stands out. I'm like, yeah, well, when you go to the laundry, when you go to the dry cleaner, you see why everybody's got the same shirt, the same five shirts.
Yeah. I always think of, and this happens every time I travel somewhere, I always think of, like, I'm going to be the guy with the wacky luggage.
Yeah, you should be a wacky luggage.
You know, because my luggage is brown or gray. I don't even know. It's like a color that it looks like every other piece of luggage. And then you see the one guy who has luggage with, like, a wacky tie around it, or it's, like, bright orange. I'm like, why?
You could be that guy.
Yeah, I want to be that guy with the wacky luggage.
You should go wacky luggage. You seem like a wacky luggage kind of guy. 708 says, you got nothing to talk about tonight? Hey, calm down. We have plenty to talk about. We're talking about Bill's pants. What's your issue? Why are you going to get up in our grill every time? I guess train the audience. If I don't have a guest in front of us, that you'll get these texts out of nowhere like, hey, slow night. Dude, this is the fifth guest on our show. We've talked about the Everglades. You know, we did a whole hour with the dude from Kubo and the Two Strings talking about animation. We did a great half hour with William Brown about Shakespeare in the Park. Coming up, we got two great comics to do the worst.
Bears.
We did Adam Hogan. Just slow your roll. Got plenty to talk about. Once in a while, we want to talk. Jeez, man. It's crazy. So much pressure. I'm a guest in studio. I'm relaxed. I'm taking the shirt off. They said, why not talk about the girl that was run over by the truck?
Oh, that's horrible.
It's a horrible story. That's, you know, and it's just bound to happen, unfortunately. And I'm, you know, I think the problem is that where that happened, there's a ton of construction. And it scares me because I know that area, Racine and Grand, and maybe not Grand, like Milwaukee,
yeah.
And I'm in that area a lot, and they're building huge condos there. And so every other day, they changed the traffic pattern. And I was reading the story that, in this case, the bike lane has been cut off.
Mm-hmm.
And so they merge all traffic, and there really isn't a sign or anything that says, hey, you know, things are going to get... Now, I don't know the situation of what happened to this poor person.
Yeah.
And, you know, any accident, especially when there's a death, you know, I don't want to speculate on what I don't have no idea. It happened in the morning. But it's a terrible story. But you just wonder about how much, you know, when there's construction, how that, you know, almost negates the all of the great strides we've made in everybody being able to get along on the street.
Mm-hmm.
Drivers, cyclists, pedestrians, that nature.
Yeah, and that stretch of Milwaukee is... In the morning.
Oh, it's just, I mean, you know, it's
bikes
intense.
And tons of bikes and tons of cars.
They interviewed someone in the story that was talking about how with the construction, the bikers are pretty aggressive there, meaning they're going into like through. It's not unheard of to have bikers pass each other. But when you pass each other, you're essentially going straight into the middle of the lane there. It's just awful. It's awful. There's not much to talk about there except for the fact that maybe there has to be some thought put into when construction projects pop up, because it's only usually a daytime thing, like in the morning where maybe they need to expand, you know, they have to a new walkway because they're building the facade or they're redirecting traffic, that there needs to be more thought put into what happens to all of the different traffic patterns.
I ride my bike fairly often, and it's treacherous. You know, I'm not like a speed demon or anything, but even just, you know, like you really have to be aggressive, I guess, but, you know, like kind of assume that everybody's going to make a bad move. You're kind of assume that there's somebody that might door you or, you know, you really have to pay attention. And, I do find it irritating that when I'm just driving down like Glenwood or residential street, you know, just like, and then, you know, somebody zips by with on your left. I'm like, okay, guy, we're not like on the track here. You have plenty of room, you know,
right.
Come on.
Yeah. But if you decide to do something out of like flail your arm,
You
smack into him.
I'm not going to flail my arm.
Yeah. But he doesn't know that.
Yeah.
You kind of have flailer written all over you.
I could see if, like, when I'm on the trail, like, we ride the lakefront trail quite a bit, and that's, you know, it's kind of close, you know, people are going both ways, you know, it's happening. I could understand, like, a guy zooming by on your left, you got to be careful, but just on, like, a residential street, no, it's, like, quiet, nobody's there, like, just, like, you know, go over 5 feet. Why do you have to, like, shock me with your dulcet timbre?
Craig Collins will, the producer, and Patty Vasquez will disagree with this because he wrote in one time about the worst. But one of the worst, you know, it's the worst. The worst is when someone flips you off in traffic. He said he's a flip-offer.
Oh, he is.
But I had that happen with a biker, not in the last couple of weeks, where he just flew right through the intersection and it was a green light, but he didn't care. He just like went through. I put a little beep on the horn. It was so suave. He didn't care. He had one hand. He didn't even look. Just flip the bird right through. Like, you know what, society? Eat it. Eat it, car. And I was just, I kind of had a smile on my face. And I turned, my son was in the car. I'm like, you see that? Did you see that? He's like, no. And I'm like, you didn't see that? I mean, this aggression will not stand. And then that was essentially the end of it.
It's going down, y'all.
It's the worst here on the download. 10 o'clock Tuesday night. Yes! We've been waiting for this all week, and we've got prizes to celebrate the worst things in our society. Got a pair of tickets to an afternoon with Priscilla Presley at the Paramount Theater. How great is that? She's going to open up about what it takes to, or what it was like to date Elvis. That's crazy. That's a crazy gift or a crazy prize, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's, I'm a little flabbergasted at the craziness of this first place prize.
It also sounds like a prize that she won. She won the chance to date Elvis.
Yeah. Oh, you get a chance
to date
her.
I thought you meant the chance to feel important.
Yeah.
I thought that's what you meant.
That's it, right. All right, we've got some great comedians in studio tonight. Kristen Toomey and Adam Burke.
Hi.
Good to see you guys.
Good to be here.
All right, so Kristen, you are the producer of Comedians You Should Know at Timothy O'Toole's every Wednesday night.
Mm-hmm.
And you also have the podcast Butt Hurt, which is great. great name for a podcast. Perfect. And you'll be performing alongside Adam Burke. Adam, how are you, man?
Good to see you. Good to be back.
He's going to at the show Camp, which is at the Village Tap in Roscoe Village.
That's the one.
Next Monday, which would be the 22nd.
Yep.
That's right. All right. Yes. So what time is that at?
8 p.m.
That's great. They do they do stand-up shows at the Village Tap now?
They do now.
Man, I spent a lot of time at the Village Tap in my day. Like, that's where they had the burritos in the back. That's good. Some nachos. They still got nachos in that place?
Where is that place?
I imagine we'll be competing.
I mean, I'm on
nachos.
The show.
Yeah.
I'm on the show. I have no idea where it is.
It's right next to the Village Discount Outlet on Roscoe. So it's in Roscoe Village, like between the Dominic's on Western and the gas station on Damon.
So over there by that gas station.
Yeah, we can go thrifting beforhand.
Okay.
And then show up in our brand new old clothes at the show.
That's right.
Yes. Perfect.
There you go.
Then you
I'm
can spill
it.
Nachos on those and nobody cares.
Yes, my nacho eating clothes. For
I bought a lot of things from that Village Discount Outlet over the years. All right, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. What's the worst? We've got some great comedians in studio tonight. And, of course, we kick things off with Pete Zimmerman. Pete.
Hey, everyone.
Hey.
Hey.
You know what's the worst?
What's the worst, Pete?
When your mail is too complicated to open.
No. It's true.
Like I don't want to perforate any. I don't want to fold any perforated lines.
Absolutely.
Oh, that is funny. And when you rip it in half, and then you see the instructions.
Just give me a regular letter. I don't want to fold both sides before you open up the one end.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Get bent.
Right.
And then you realize there's like a return envelope, and you've destroyed that.
Yeah. Or the worst is you don't even realize it's a check. You know, and it's like something that's coming back like the 18 cents from AT&T or whatever. And you're I just ripped this.
It's never a check.
It's never a check. It really isn't. You think it's a check. You go to cash it in and you just signed up for 3 more years.
Right.
It was a subpoena.
Yeah, exactly. Subpoenas are the worst.
Subpoenas are the worst.
They're the worst.
They sound like the worst. What a gross word.
Yeah. It sounds like underwater genitals.
Is that allowed?
Those are both fine Merriam-Webster words.
Yes, that works. No,
Us going into the booth 30 seconds in, that's the worst.
I like it. That's a strong AM radio move right there. Yeah, that evaded FCC requirement. I like that. All right, so let's keep going. Kristen, what's the worst, Kristen?
The worst. Oh, well, this happened to me tonight. I was at Target.
Great place.
And which is the best.
The best.
Okay, that's a different segment. But the worst was the person in front of me, the family, I should say, were buying shoes, and they were unaware of the BOGO.
Oh, no.
So guess what? 5 of them went back to go pick out shoes.
Yeah.
Which is not a quick grab. And at this point, I had unloaded 300 items onto the cart, onto the belt, so I wasn't going
to
move aisles.
You can't move. You're stuck.
Also,
but
they
just went shoe shopping.
The way you said it, you made...
They're the worst.
Not the
situation. Yeah. Those people.
Target's not the worst. The situation is not the people are the
those
worst.
Those people are the worst.
The way you said it, you made BOGO sound like an Eastern European mythical monster. They were unaware of the BOGO.
Lurking below. Buy one, get one.
Yeah, there is something
half
great
off,
to that.
I think,
because you only really have, like, the rules of society say you can run back to get something perishable.
Yeah.
Right? Like, oh, I forgot milk. And you know, that's the reason I came here, so I can run back and get that.
Diapers, I'm about it.
Yeah, you're about it. But if it's, like, a 2-for-1... and you're going to go get another pair of shoes. That's crazy.
Some stores, those shoes are perishable. Those shoes aren't making it out.
True. But, I mean, to send your 4 kids, you're already getting a deal.
That is funny, though. When,
you know?
When you
get
know,
out of line, then.
Yeah, get lost.
And were you staring at the cashier going, don't tell them, don't tell them?
I was in a weird place because it was like, how patient can I be here? Like. Yeah. And I huffed and puffed, but that did nothing. You know, that's just like
of,
I had to get
a
it
lot
out.
Of size, you were doing some size.
Yeah, just tapping my fingers. Just rearranging my stuff on the belt. You know, just pushing it closer, even though the belt's not moving.
I think that's a measure of patience. 5 pairs of shoes worth of patience.
That was a lot. Yeah. Like that was Buddhist level.
Yeah, that's really high up there.
I had to zone out because I was like, I could just pinch your face, lady. Like I wanted to pinch her cheeks.
Have you ever pinched a stranger?
No, but I
resist
that urge.
This could have been it.
it.
Yeah.
Could have been it.
Oh, the joy.
One more pair of shoes and I would have been pinching.
The endorphins you're going to feel when you finally do.
When I finally do, I'm going to unleash.
Unleash hell.
It's going to be a BOGO.
All right.
I'm going to unleash the BOGO.
Oh, this is brilliant. Brilliant. All right, Adam, what's the worst?
When your computer dies right in the middle of you working on something and you have that sinking feeling in the pit of your stomach that turning it back on isn't going to do anything. And I love that move we do when you turn on your laptop or your computer and it's clearly dead. It's got that, like, I'm gone. And you hit all the keys. I love the notion that that would be the procedure. Like, you open up the book and it says work. in the unlikely in case your computer freezes, hit JJ the space key, swear three times, and then like punch it and it'll turn back on, no problem.
Yeah, that's so true. What if it worked? You're like, I'm really
pinch it. Just pinch it.
Pinch it. All right, we wake it up.
You know what's the worst for me is like when I know my computer's gonna die and the cord is just out of reach.
And I
don't want to roll off the bed to get the cord. And I'm like, I'll just wait it out.
You do. You're like, how much gas is left in this thing? We're going all the way.
Yeah.
We're going
Can I finish?
I do love how, because the computer is a type of computer named after a sort of fruit. And they, I love that they're like, thing Adele. Is, they're so easy to use. They're so friendly to use. And then when it breaks, you have to get in touch with a genius. There's a bar of genius. I always want to walk in and just see Faraday and Diogenes, Tesla. Even they would go, turn it off, turn it back on again.
Yeah.
Hit the JJ space button.
Pinch it.
Chris and Toomey, Adam Burke, we're playing the worst. 312-981-7200. When we come back, we'll read some of the texts and get your calls. 312-981-7200. Come on back. It's the worst here on the download. Tuesday night, 10 o'clock. We always play. We always complain about the worst things in society for prizes. Tonight's no different. Kristen Toomey and Adam Burke in studio. Kristen is the producer of Comedians You Should Know, the Wednesday showcase at Timothy O'Toole's right around the corner here in Streeterville, and also the podcast Butthurt. Great name. Adam Burke is going to be at camp as well as Kristen, which is a showcase at the Village Tap on Monday night, August 22nd. What did we say? 9 o'clock?
8 o'clock.
7th o'clock. Just get there. It's Village Tap, man. Just show up.
Get some nachos.
Yeah, we'll meet you in the discount.
Where is the show? Is the show in the back area?
We have no idea. We have no information.
Man, I'm so intrigued.
Yeah, we'll just come along.
Most of the time, we just get the show.
Yeah.
We just get addresses and time frame, and we show up hopes of a crowd. And
this will be the Renaissance time they talk about in Chicago history. Remember that time when you just got an address, you showed up and did comedy.
Yeah.
That's it.
It's
kind sometimes of like, you got murdered. Yes. I don't know. Yeah,
it's kind of similar.
Got paid. Wow. Surprise both times.
Similar to the instructions Robert Johnson got when he met the devil. Like, it's kind of like...
It's very similar.
At the stroke of midnight.
Goes around, comes around, right? Yeah. Right. All right. So 312-981-7200. Let's see. 708 says, the worst is when you're in a public restroom with no shelf or ledge, so you place your purse in the sink, only to realize it's an automatic faucet.
Yes.
That's happened to you.
Oh, my gosh. Yes. That has happened to me many times. And because there's nowhere to put it. And, like, if you're doing your makeup, and then you have to prop it where, like, it's not gonna trigger the faucet. And then the strap will fall. And just topples. Oh, it's awful. Yeah, it's a real.
We could do a how to improve purse situation.
Get on it, science. Yeah. Tell the difference between a purse strap and a hand.
We're right by the tech sector here. They can't figure that out.
What willowy people have a hand so thin and lissom? It's the same consistency as a purse strap. That person shouldn't be allowed in public or public restrooms.
All right. 6262 says the worst is when your 18-year-old daughter brags that she's going to her first Bears game. And then they get shut out for the first time since 1981. Yeah. Still, I don't think she cared.
There's a lot going on there.
Yeah. Mm. There's a lot. It starts a certain way and it ends a certain way.
Were you not invited? What was the
problem? Maybe.
Yeah. Maybe because she's bad luck.
I think it's because she was dating one of the players. I think that was the main.
Imagine that.
The main
issue. Oh, jeez. Like,
okay.
Aww.
Okay. You know what's the worst? Going to the bathroom in a public restroom. A lot of public restroom stuff.
Sure.
Washing your hands, having to use a hand dryer, then touching the door handle to get out.
Yeah.
That's the worst.
Oh, yeah. So this guy's saying that things aren't automated enough.
Right.
That's his problem. We still have door handles? No, I want the Star Trek doors to just shoot open.
Well, there is something to that. The idea that you have to touch a knob after you cleaned your hands thoroughly.
Yeah.
Maybe there's something there.
This is like that scene in The Aviator. Do you remember that where he had a stand? He stood in the bathroom until somebody came because he was out of Kleenex.
Right, and he couldn't.
Like, that's this listener's.
Yeah, same,
he's like,
same
I've
idea.
Done the... I've done that.
Okay, but
that scene really hit home.
If everyone if everyone washes their hands, then the inside door handle is going to be clean.
Yeah, but not everybody does.
Well,
so see, that's the problem.
So few people.
Society.
You know why we don't? Because the sinks are full of purses. That's the problem.
All right, let's go to the phones. 312-981-7200. Let's go to Gary. Gary, you got a bad drive-through experience. What's the worst, Gary?
The worst is when you go to the drive-through. I go in there, and of course you're in line forever. Mm-hmm. And you get up to the window, and all you hear is wah wah wah. You know, you can barely understand. And you get finally get your stuff ordered, and you get to the window, and they're like, "Oh, you know, you're gonna have to go ahead and park over and stall too, because we're gonna make the fries fresh for you."
Right.
So I tell them, "No, don't worry about making them fresh for me. I'll just take whatever you got in there."
What do they say?
We don't have any. I said, "Oh, I thought you were just making them fresh for me." And then I tell them, "Don't worry about it. I'm fine. I can sit here and wait." "Well, no, you got to pull up to number two." And it's like, "Well, no, I'll wait. I'm fine sitting here." "Yeah, well, there's other people." And I'm like, "Oh, okay."
So, so the experience, really, what the worst is getting lied to at a drive-thru, fast food drive-thru.
They're liars, I'm telling you.
I love this fierce battle of wits at the drive-thru. How dare you, sir? I know what's going on.
Yeah, that's some
up to no good.
That's some serious protest going on there, yeah. Gary. Thanks for doing that for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
We appreciate it. All right, good stuff. Matt, what's the worst, Matt?
I've got two. Number one, the worst is when you just get done telling your 7-year-old niece that you're not going anywhere anytime soon, and then your mother chimes in and says, "Oh, honey, I promise I'm not going anywhere either, or at least I won't until I die like the cat did."
You got a life lesson, man. It's a life lesson.
And
right?
I'm sitting there thinking, what is... Stop talking. And well, then the second one is when your mother calls you at 7:30 in the morning and wakes you up saying, "I'm at the grocery store and my remote to my car died and I can't get in." And you say, "What about the key that you've had for 2 years?" "What key?" So you have to get up, drive to the grocery store after getting dressed at 7:30 in the morning, take the key from her hand, pull out the hidden key that is in the actual key fob, and then drive all the way back home and get back into bed.
This is so specific. These are both so specific.
Yeah. That is the worst.
First of all, the first one, the first part of that, I love. I love the grandma says, "I'll die like the cat did." How did the cat die? Did the cat die of mange? Because then...
Just old age.
That's an interesting cat.
The
grandmother.
Cat was, I think the cat was 17 years old.
Okay.
So it was old cat.
Okay, well, at least that makes sense as opposed to like getting hit by a truck.
Yeah.
That would be the worst.
Yeah, exactly. That would be
the cat got eaten by raccoons or something. Yeah. That would be frightening.
Thanks, Matt.
Oh, hey, speaking of raccoons, what happened to the guy with the raccoons in his yard?
I know. That was the worst. That was the worst, what Matt's referring to. Thanks, Matt. He was feeding the raccoons.
Mm.
And then while he was selling his house, and so it was like worst was his, I think it was his behavior of like the idea that then they came around after the house was the new neighbors came in.
Right. And the raccoons are like, "We thought this was cool, man."
It's not us, man.
The new neighbors are like, "What is, it's like the birds, but with raccoons."
And the raccoons are like, "This neighborhood's changed. This used to be cool."
Gentrification of this block.
The worst is going to pick up a prescription and having found out they filled the prescription with the wrong medication and then finding out that they called my insurance and doctor and changed my prescription. Yeah, that's a lot.
I have one about prescriptions.
All right, well, give it to us.
When my Xanax won't be refilled for a few days, it's illegal for them to do it within a certain amount of days.
Are you hitting the Xanax too fast? Is that what the thing is? Like, they only let you do it for 30 days?
I fly sometimes.
Okay. Yeah.
No, Kristen, that's the worst, but it's the worst for other people when you're off your Xanax.
Exactly. For my family, my husband, my children. Right. It's the worst.
We're writing the pharmacy going, please make an exception.
Like, character letters and stuff like a court case. Please.
All right.
That's the worst.
312-981-7200. All right. So 630 says, the worst is finally getting the courage to go talk to a girl at the bar, and then immediately after introducing yourself, she throws up on you. What do you think? Is that real? You think that's real? I mean, maybe he's pinpointing the drunkest person in the room.
I don't think that's the worst. I think that is a quick way to figure out what you can put up with this person. You know what I mean? Like, is she attractive enough where you continue?
You know what I mean? You got to be real hot.
Yeah, there's a level. There's a barf level.
There's a barf level?
Yeah.
I want to be barf level hot.
Barf hot?
Barf hot. Like, I'm going to go home and wake up my husband and say, honey, am I barf hot? He's going to say no.
No.
And then go, are you sure?
You're not wake me up in the middle of the night hot.
Right.
Yeah.
Are you sure? And then throw up on him. Just so I got to know.
Check it out.
I got
to
know.
All right. 708 says, you know what's the worst? Driving in heavy traffic on a very trying day and being honked at by what you think is just some impatient driver, and in your anger, you flip them off, only to see it's a close friend's grandmother who just wanted to wave hello.
Oh, no. That is the worst.
That's kind of a leading candidate right there.
That's a good one. I really hope she flipped them off back.
She's getting all mad. 319 says, the worst is having a sinus infection during the summer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's been going around. A lot of people have had like colds and
I got a kind of a related medical one because it kind of comes
a lot
that.
Of medical tonight. That's the theme of tonight's
This is going to sound very bland at first. Is migraines are the worst because
migraines are the worst.
I don't know if anyone gets it, but the thing when I was a kid, when I was younger, I always thought migraines were like a middle class affectation. I thought they were like things only characters on Dynasty got. You know what I mean? Like, oh, it was such a terrible migraine.
Dramatic, yeah.
From all, the weight of all this jewelry. And then when I actually got it, I think people don't really know what migraines are. Do you get them, Kristen?
No.
They make you blind. So you actually go blind, and it's you're like, I got a migraine, and people are like, you know, life's hard all over, buddy. It's like, no, I can't cross the street right now.
Oh, my gosh, really?
Yeah. They're
it's
really
that
how
bad?
Often do you get
I know people
about once every 2 months.
Throw up.
They're real bad. But jeez. I used to make fun of people for them.
But the idea of the worst is when people make fun of migraines.
Yeah, migraines, really? Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Boo-hoo.
I think I have a migraine coming on. Oh, okay. All right. Well, you know what?
You know, I can't see you rolling your eyes because I'm blind.
All right. 815. We'll do one more, and then we'll take a break for the news. The worst is going to the drive-thru and ordering a hamburger with only ketchup and onion. And then you drive away, and you take out your sandwich, and you find that you have two buns with only ketchup and onion and no hamburger.
Oh, man.
Pretty good.
That's
someone who just quit.
Yeah. In the middle of it? Yeah. You know what? I'm not doing this. I'm not assembling your
burger. No, that's someone who went, we're going to make fresh burgers for you. Well, just give me what you have. Okay, I will.
Adam Burke, Kristen Toomey in studio tonight. We're playing the worst. We'll take a break. We'll get the news. We'll come back. We'll continue. 312-981-7200. Stay with us. What's going down, That's bad. Playing the worst here on the download, 312-981-7200. Justin Kaufman here. Kristen Toomey, Adam Burke in studio.
Hello.
All right, Kristen is the producer of Comedians You Should Know every Wednesday at Timothy O'Toole's, also her podcast, Butthurt. Adam Burke is going to stand-up comedian as well. He's going to be at Camp, the show at the Village Tap on Monday, the 22nd. Kristen will be there as well. This is... right by that Starbucks.
Yep.
Not too far from the legendary rock club Bedrocks. which is not there. Don't look for it. It's not there anymore.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Right. Were you born on that corner?
No, I just
you
know a lot about it.
You used to sell papers on that corner.
Yeah. There also there's a right across the street. That neighborhood is, when I moved to Chicago in 1992, that's where I was at, Roscoe and Damon. And it's an entirely different neighborhood now. Mm-hmm. Now, back then it was rough. And there was a bar, there's a biker bar right where the Village Tap is. And that if you'll look when you go to play at Village Tap, you'll be like, there's no place for a biker bar here. It's all yuppied out.
Oh, yeah.
It was called the Black Tulip.
Oh, that's a good name for a biker. Yeah. Oh, that's a solid nice biker
and it
bar.
And it was an old school, like, like aluminum tiled kind of building. And you couldn't really see it. It was like slit windows kind of thing. And it was like, I remember you could see like purple neon kind of coming out of it.
Oh, cool.
And then there was a big like biker stabbing there. And they bounced that place quick.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I would have thought biker bars, you got like one a year.
I think that's the problem. I think they might have been on two or three.
Oh, okay.
I don't think it was the first.
Three stabs are out?
Yeah, something tells me this is the third stab. That's my guess.
Sure.
I was new to the area. I'm
Where
sure
are
it wasn't.
From?
I'm from Wonder Lake, Illinois.
Okay.
Which
Where is
about
that?
An hour and a half northwest.
Northwest. Okay.
A little lake town in McHenry County. And I came here in 1992 to go to Columbia College. And I've been here ever since.
Okay.
So if you have any other questions about Roscoe in 1992 wow. area.
And draw us a map later.
Village Chap was there. So that's all I know. So tell him Justin said hi when you go in there. Don't know.
We do.
They're like, Justin died years ago.
Kristen and I do tours of Chicago that are incredibly specific.
Very, exactly.
And terribly unpopular.
All right. Let's get back to these, the worst. 312-981-7200. 214, the worst is when you're given the bum rush by the clerk at the 7-Eleven when you're trying to choose a candy bar.
Oh, that's...
Can I help you? Yeah, you can help me. Shut up long enough so I can decide between a Reese's Pieces and an O. Henry.
Yes. Oh, I love O. Henry.
I love that we've got sassy 9-year-olds calling in. It's a little 1930s.
It really
little
was.
Mickey Rooney kid. Yeah.
But quick, you're stand-up comedians. That was a well-constructed joke.
I
that was
appreciate
pretty good.
That one. Yeah. That is a contender in my book.
Yeah, there you
that's
go.
A good one.
773 says, the worst when you try to call in sick to work and then your supervisor talks you into coming in.
Oh, yeah. Guilt trip.
There's an addendum that says someone else called before you, .. That's true.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
true.
Yeah.
When you don't have the mettle to finish the call in sick. And you know, and the corporation's not dumb.
Yeah. Sure.
They put the best like negotiators in those positions.
Yeah.
Like I would never when I would work at the grocery store growing up, I'd do that like, oh man, I'm not going to work. Oh, hello. And the person I would talk to would be Jenny from customer service, and Jenny doesn't mess around.
Yeah.
She'd use that charm, and next thing you know, you're like, I'll come in. I'll be there.
I do like the work ethic of the person who called in sick before you.
Yeah,
you know, you got to get up pretty early to not go into work.
Before Jenny cares too much. Yeah.
Exactly. They'll give you the first one because you're like, well, we always got Todd.
Right.
He's coming in.
I get up at the crack of dawn to make sure I can sleep all day. You know what I mean?
All right, let's keep going. 773, you finish off the supersized drink, jump on the L at 95th to downtown, stops midway for repairs. I'm stuck crazily doing the pee-pee dance the last two stops.
Yeah, it's time to fill up that cup.
Oh, man. Fitting in on the old red line. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No, please don't do that.
Yeah, please
I'd love to see someone who had like a beautiful pee-pee dance. You know what I mean?
Like contemporary
dance. Just wonderful.
Like
just
Hubbard
people,
Street kind of thing.
People would always arrange for that person to always never be able to go to the bathroom just so they could watch it.
And push them out on stage.
Yeah.
Like just wonderful. Priscilla Presley.
What an amazing, amazing.
Oh, that's PP. That's where she gets. That's where it comes from.
Oh,
sure.
It is. There it is. Yeah. 630 says, when I have a bag and I take my dog out and it turns out to be a 2-bag walk.
Oh.
That would be the one time it'd be great if dogs could talk. If dogs could just look at it.
This
is going to be a 2-bagger. Okay?
It's going to be a 2-bagger.
You're going to need to double
up. Don't tie that.
Yeah.
I find myself holding the bag out in case anyone is looking to prove that I'm not irresponsible. Like it's the dog's fun. So he holds the bag out when the dog's going again, like, hey, you know, I got a bag already. Look at me. Don't get on me.
The dog's
good. Like, I like that.
Yeah, I'm going to make a fresh one for you. No, it's okay.
312, the worst is watching beach volleyball and not being able to tell who scored because the losers enthusiastically cheer as much as the winners.
Yes, and I was not aware, but we happen to be watching, or it's on.
It's right here in the studio,
and
yeah.
We were paying attention.
And you can't really tell who's winning and who's losing.
You can't.
They do.
It's so supportive. Ugh.
It's gross. It's almost as if they're trying to psych the other team out. You just act like you're winning. I kind of swore we just won that point, but those two are hugging each other real hard.
They're right. Playing right into it by getting that point. That's
just, won't they be defeated?
We've got them right where we want them.
Right.
Yeah. They're mainly scored on their celebrations. That's how this game is. It's kind of like 40% the actual.
Extra, like an 8.3 for celebration.
Exactly, yeah.
So who can high-five the hardest?
Right,
that's
right.
Really, that's
the
real
it's a lot game. Of the same skills. It's just putting your hand up and hitting something. It's very similar.
Volleying. Yeah, practice volleying.
Right.
Maybe
there's
that's
a lot
what they're
going
doing.
On. Look at how many people are at the – it's the Brazilian team that right now is hurting the U.S. squad. And right now it is packed, sold out to the gills, everybody from Brazil, because Brazil is the team that could beat the U.S. and they are beating them.
It's
this is Kerry Walsh.
Home turf. Yeah. Energy.
And they just are better celebrators.
But just, exactly. No one celebrates better than the Brazilians.
Nobody.
Yeah, really.
All right, Pete, why don't we go back around the horn before we take a break, and then we'll get some more people, and we'll do our judging. 312-981-7200. What's the worst? We got prizes, an afternoon with Priscilla Presley at the Paramount. We got a gift card for Pequod's Pizza and also a MyPillow. I love it. I love that you complain about the site and you get a pillow. It's kind of the coolest thing in radio of all time. All right, Pete, what else you got today?
You know what's the worst?
What's the worst, Pete?
When you have to go into a gas station to pay.
Oh, it's so the worst.
You're at the dock or whatever, and the credit card thing doesn't work, and you're trying to press buttons, and then you're like, you have to come in for that one.
And I still, to this day, don't even know what I'm doing when I come in there. Like, I'm not sure if I did it right, or I just like I don't have enough experience in being a indoor gas station customer to know what to do. Right? That's the problem where I'm just like, I hand my card and they go, "What is this for?" I'm like, I just kind of point at the car out there because I don't know, what is it, a pump? What is it?
When you go in, there's always one guy who's just standing in there. He's not buying anything. He's not doing anything. And I think he's someone like you who's so stymied by what to do. He's been there for 4 weeks. He's so embarrassed. He doesn't know what to do.
I always think it's somebody that's trying to make friends with the worker.
Yeah.
And it's just pretending to wait for fresh taquitos or whatever.
Or it is their friend.
But it is. Like, well, because it's been forced upon the worker
this
point.
At
this point, you know?
It's just loneliness.
Yeah,
but he's never standing. He's never standing.
There's always somebody there trying to make friends has successfully made friends.
Right. But he's never standing in a place that makes sense.
No,
he's always just near the window washer fluid, like for no reason.
Or he's always like, in the weird, like he's always by the hot food. It's like he likes the smell of the hot food. He's the worst.
We've come up with another worst. That guy. Mm-hmm. All right, Adam, what do you got for another worst?
Just because my girlfriend is going through this at the moment. Identity theft is the worst.
Oh, yeah.
Just because it now, I don't know if you heard about this, it's so easy now. Because if you can find a place.
It's going to happen to all of us, man.
If you can find a place that can, just use it, not to tell you how to do it, but apparently, if they find out your routing number and your account number, which are handily on every check you've ever written.
No, don't say this, man. You're just going to blueprint.
I'm taking notes.
Yeah,
So here's the thing. I think that's too easy. I think if you're going to steal someone's identity, go the whole hog. Dress up like them. Go to all their appointments.
It's the only way it's accepted.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Go to their job.
If you show up for a teeth cleaning, they're like, you're already here.
Yeah. You know what? That would make more sense. And I would. And you play to the ego. The hubris of the criminal,
right?
Where you're like, that was nothing. Anyone could do that.
Yeah.
If you're a real criminal, you're going to go the full nine. Adam wears a tie.
Yeah.
Get up in there. Understand.
Yeah. I want you to do my chores for me. I want to come home and the fridge is stocked. My girlfriend's like, you did.
Your movies like did this, such aren't a great there? Job. The movies that the guys get replaced. Guy gets amnesia or something.
Yeah.
He comes back and he's replaced by someone.
Changeling.
Or something like that. All right, Chris, you got any more?
I do. This happened to me today, and it happens to me all the time. I don't know what I'm doing wrong, but I cannot wash my... I'm going to pause for a minute so people laugh. Because you don't know what I'm going to say.
Yeah, right.
My mascara off. I can't. I don't know if other women have this problem, but I wash my face. I get a facial. It doesn't matter. I always have a line. Like, I can always have mascara coming up. I can never get it fully off. And it's not even waterproof.
You know, I have to say, and I'll say this because I did a short film with Steve Delahoy, the great Steve Delahoy.
Yeah.
Where I played a woman. And I remember Monique did the makeup for me, and she did the eyeliner and the mascara and the whole bit. And I did this whole, had this wig, and it was a great little bit. And it was super hard to get the makeup off. I now have an understanding of women every night where I'm like, this is ridiculous. It's ridiculous how much I was like, it was with me for like 3 days. I still had like people are like, what's wrong with your eyes? I'm like, get away from me, man.
Yeah, and you know what?
Don't tell me to smile.
Okay, so I have wipes. I have the soap. I have all of this. And then I swear, I will rub my eye and there is still mascara. I'm no way. I just spent $200 on a facial. Why is there mascara?
Right.
I paid someone to wash my face.
You need to get that bat.
Could you hire those guys or those guys that wash
wash
graffitis off the side of buildings? Like they could just erect a scaffold and just come off.
Like I take a water pick and I'm like doing power washing
just
my face.
Just kind of shield the eyeballs. Yeah. And then you get a graffiti blaster.
My girlfriend's a burlesque dancer and she does a pretty good job with it. I think there's like
what a humble here. That's the worst.
That is the worst.
Oh, you're dating a burlesque dancer? You're the worst.
But that's true. But I'm saying that she has as much removal product as she has addition products. Yeah, exactly.
And it's such a pain, you know, and it's like then you just look like a raccoon in the guy's yard.
Is it like an acid bath?
Yeah, it's exactly. It's me out there. It's been feeding me.
Kristen Toomey, Adam Burke. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back and we will award the top three worst tonight on the download. Stay with us.
What's going down, y'all? The worst come the worst, my people come first. When worst come the worst, when worst come the worst, my people come first.
It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman, Kristen Toomey, Adam Burke in studio.
Hello.
All right, so let's read what we have. We got a couple more here. 708 says, try Neutrogena Fresh Foaming Cleanser.
Oh, thank you.
There you go.
I'm writing it down.
Have a good night. That's how they ended it.
All right, I will.
708 says, you know what's the worst? People that bring babies to R-rated movies.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's especially bad when the baby is like a movie snob, you know, and they're like, "What? It's not as good as his early work."
It's like a little stupid.
Real.
I love the second part of this text is just leave your kid in the parking lot, please.
Well, it's like just wait for DVD if you can't get a sitter. You know, I have
that
kids
is, the th- but it's not
never,
even that anymore.
But you can't even enjoy it if you have a newborn with you.
Yeah, right.
Most movies they want to shove movies in your face so hard now, you really only have to wait about 5 days.
Showing the trailers on Comcast.
Your home at TV is bigger than some cinema screens at this point. Like, why?
You can order, like it says, gives the option of still in theaters.
Right.
You can do.
Yeah.
That's for the babies.
It's for the babies.
Right. 224 says the worst for the babies. I told this story before on The Worst where I was watching Eight Mile. Eminem in a theater, and
great
two
movie.
Kids just got. We got to the point where it was the big ending, the rap battle, and two kids were so bored, 7 year olds, 8 year olds in this rated R Eminem 8 Mile, that they just started doing big Matt Fulea fish quarter pound, like they were doing like the hand thing.
Oh, okay, but how much better would that movie have been if that was the finale?
And truthfully, I remember it, so I'm like, that's like whenever I see that. Okay, step up, go get him, rabbit.
Yeah.
I'm like,
yeah. I used to be the
big
best.
Matt Fulea.
I worked so hard to be the best patty caker in all of Michigan.
That would be a great movie.
Yeah, it's a great.
That is riveting. The underworld of patty cake.
Patty cake mile.
224 says the worst is passive aggressive people.
Yes, very true.
Well, I think I know why they're saying that.
Then they say, and then you get mad and you end up being passive aggressive back.
Yes.
It's a vicious cycle.
Yeah. I mean, the listeners are killing it tonight.
630 says Maybelline waterproof mascara remover in the pink cap.
Okay. Writing it down.
Write it down.
I am. Thank you.
Got a Neutrogena Maybelline war.
630, have you tried baby oil to remove mascara? I think we hit it on. They don't want the worst. They want to talk about your makeup issues.
See?
This is going to be an offshoot of this show. Yeah, right. We're going to have like 45 minutes of the worst and 15 minutes of makeup removal.
I'm loving these tips. Thank you.
262 says the worst is when your two-year-old moves the dog water dish in the middle of the kitchen and you fall flat on your face while heading to work.
Okay, but that means you are Dick Van Dyke. That's what that means.
That is a classic
That's
bit.
How you found it.
The music's in the background. Right.
Oh, I love him.
219 says the worst is going to your local coffee shop and forgetting to have your card stamped so it actually takes 15 coffees to get your free one instead of 10.
Yeah, that sounds
that's
like,
so true.
That sounds like a really bleak, like Norwegian film. You know, just the guy, the guy sitting in his car, aren't
staring. He never gets the free one. He's only got. He's like every day, yeah. And it's just like a calendar, mm-hmm. a desk calendar,
and there's Philip Glass music playing in the background.
It's black and white, and there's leaves falling.
But isn't that at the end of the day? Totally. Isn't that the idea of those cards? I mean, they're trying to get you like they're just like the old Saturday Night Live where they got the dime even though the guy ripped stuff off. Like, they're like, we got it. We win.
Wait, no. And then the movie ends with he gets it and he spills it.
Yeah, right.
And then it goes Finn.
He trips over. He trips over his dog's water tray and he spills it.
Yes.
All right. 847, the worst is when you think you look really hot and then you're the life of the party and then you come home and you look in the mirror. And you see a big, black, unknown chunk between your teeth. Oh, that's bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you know what you need to remember, Barb? That's Barb in that case?
Don't say her name.
No, she put it on there. Okay. She put it on there.
Like, we have
Barb,
all,
you know, you thought, all of that, you were. You were the life of the party.
Yeah.
You were hot. Doesn't matter what was
even
in your teeth.
Even with that.
Yeah, with that. You rocked it with that.
Yes.
And then she,
so true.
Yes, next time she goes to a party, she's no one's interested in her, and she goes into the bathroom, just puts a big chunk of black crap between her teeth. I don't know what it is, but
Barb got her chunk back.
Yeah. I mean, it's essentially what David Letterman did. He had a big gap between his teeth.
Yeah, I have a gap.
You have a little
and
one.
And I'm the life of...
Yeah, of several parties.
773 says Vaseline works like a charm.
Okay.
And 773 says olive oil.
Oh.
You know what?
Almond oil.
I really hope
or
that you're...
Or almond.
I really hope that you're just getting these as single word texts.
They are.
Vaseline, olive oil.
Last one, 608 says the worst is making an accidental swipe on Tinder and you can't undo it. Is that the thing?
Is that how that works?
I
don't
know. I think you just got three people who don't do Tinder, so I don't know.
But that's the thing. I don't know if you can speak to this, Kristen. older heads, we've had like real life accidental swipes.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
Accidental swipe is just what, like, in real life, an accidental swipe is like 3 days.
Off. Yeah, you could turn your phone off.
Right.
Like, you can't turn your body off.
All right, let's do this. Should we do this? Let's wrap it up. The download prizes we're giving away. Third place,
drum
a
roll.
MyPillow. Guaranteed the most comfortable pillow you'll ever own. Visit MyPillow.com. Second place, going to get your Pequod's Pizza gift card featuring world-famous pizza with the signature caramelized crust. Visit them in Chicago or Morton Grove or online at PequodsPizza.com. First place, you're going to get a pair of tickets to an afternoon with Priscilla Presley at the Paramount Theater in Aurora on Sunday, August 21st. Priscilla opens up about what it was like to date Elvis, move to Graceland, and live with the tabloid headlines in a candid conversation about her life with never-before-seen home movies and photos and a Q&A with the audience.
Nice.
Oh, wow.
Get tickets at 630-896-6666 or online at ParamountAurora.com. All right, so third place. Here we go.
Drum rolls. The tension is high.
I'm looking for the third place. Oh, here we go. Third place. Shannon's going to get third place. But the worst is when you're in a public restroom with no shelf or ledge, so you place your purse in the sink only to realize it's an automatic faucet.
Yes.
That is a problem that has not been fixed in society.
That needs to be fixed.
All right.
That's the next Nobel Prize
that
winner.
That is the worst.
That is the worst. And you get a pillow for that. 708 says, you know what's the worst? Driving in heavy traffic on a very trying day, being honked at by what you think is just some impatient driver, and in your anger, you flip them off, only to see It's your close friend's grandmother honking to wave hello.
Yeah, whoops.
What makes that funnier in your mind? That she gasps or she just frowns?
Or she does it back. That would be great.
There's a lot of options there. Options for grandma. Friend's grandma.
Like it's your grandma? Right.
Yeah, you got to be. It's a friend's grandma. It's a close friend's grandma. All right, so let's go with number one. Number one is going to go to a caller, Gary. Gary did justice. Mm-hmm. He became a protester, a social protester for the Times to tell fast food drive-thrus. We're not
going to
take it anymore. You did one for everybody. In history, they're going to look back.
Yeah.
And they're going to be like, Gary. Textbooks are going to be written about Gary, who said, you know what? Yeah. I'm waiting right here. I'm not moving up to the...
Hashtag I'm with Gary.
I'm with Gary. Gary, congratulations.
Hashtag I'll wait.
I'll wait.
Hash Browns, I'm with Gary.
Gary, so this is a big moment for you. You thought at first you were just doing it just for the fries, but now it's a movement. How do you feel?
I feel wonderful.
All right, there you go. And you know what? From here on out, I can only speak for myself, but I am with you. The next time that I roll up to a Culver's or another place where they're like, move to another space, I'm going to be like, no, Gary didn't.
Gary.
Gary didn't.
What would Gary do?
What would Gary do?
Yeah. And Gary, are you an Elvis fan?
What's that, Gary?
Yeah, actually, I said drive-through lives matter.
All right.
There you go.
I love Elvis, actually.
And there you go.
Oh, good.
You can get an afternoon with Priscilla Presley. Gary, thanks. Stay on the line. Thanks so much for playing tonight. Thanks to everybody who called and texted in. Big night.
Yeah, killed it tonight.
How about it? Kristen Toomey, thanks for being here. Adam Burke.
Thank you, sir.
You see both you guys at camp at the Village Tap on Monday night, the 22nd stand-up showcase in Roscoe Village. And also, Kristen, you can see our Comedians You Should Know on Wednesday nights. You guys, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. Tomorrow night, very excited. My guest at the big table will be Ikram Goldman. Ikram is considered to be the first lady of fashion. She has her store in Gold Coast, but she is known world-renowned for her work. We'll talk with her about the fashion industry, high fashion, and its relationship to Chicago. That's tomorrow night here on The Download. Patty Vasquez up next with Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez. I'm Justin Kaufman. See you tomorrow.